It's an honor for us to have him here. It's an honor for me to introduce him. And actually, the best introduction would have been simply that he needs no introduction, I should sit down. But then I would not have been true to the shlichus that Rabbi Ebner and Rabbi Sussman in their graciousness have extended to me. So I just want to say one word. In the Chumash, it's written when it speaks about Yisachar, the Chumash speaks about Yisachar, Chamargorev, Rabbi Ben Al-Mishklaim, Vayamanucha Kitov, Vetoretzki Naima, Vayet Shichmo Lisbol. In other words, he works very hard. What does Yisachar very hard? We know that Yisachar is, of course, the symbol of Torah. So Rashi says two things there. Rashi says, number one, Vayet Shichmo Lisbol, he works hard, lifts a psakim, to pass the shilas. And the second thing Rashi says, Vayet Shichmo Lisbol, he works hard, Lichboish, to conquer. You would think that somebody who works hard at Pesachim, who knows wherever you talk to him about, that you start talking in Eben Ezer or in Nidda or in Brachas or in Ahalas, etc., knows so much, he's in his own world. Where does he even have time to do Lichboish, to conquer the world, to go out in the world? Or somebody is involved in kibush, conquering the world, where does he have time to have so much? You think that doesn't exist. But there is, we are honored in our generation, and we are lucky in our generation, that we have such a person. That person is Rav Hershel Shechter Shliter. Wherever you ask him, wherever, he's there. And you think, where does he have time to lecture and go from here and to there and to conquer people with his lectures? You think that he doesn't have that time, and he does have that time. It's a great honor to introduce that symbol of Yisachar, the person who, number one, he's Kovesh, he conquers people for Torah, and he paskens for Torah, the person who combines it in one personality. Harav Shecht.
Thank you very much. You wouldn't believe it. When I got married, we had the Sheva Brachas in the yeshiva. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein spoke at the Sheva Brachas, and he quoted the same pasuk, and he spoke about me. And my mother-in-law was there, so he said, he's comparing him to an ezel. He's comparing me to a chamor. Thank you very much. Let's see, we have a list of questions here. We'll try to work on the questions. Let's see. Can you be a kohen in medical school? One of the 613 mitzvahs in the Torah is that a kohen is not permitted to come in contact with a mace. We assume contact means three kinds, maga and masa and ohal. Maga means if I touch the mace. Masa means if I'm wearing gloves and I'm not touching the mace, but I move the mace. Yeah, this is masa. Even if I'm wearing gloves, that's masa. And then ohal is if I'm in this room and the mace is over there and there's the same roof extending over me and the mace, that's also tumah, that's tumas ohal. The Gemara has a dispute among the Tanaim where they may say Akum, a non-Jewish dead body, is metameh ba'ohel, and there's a dispute in the Rishonim how to paskin. So in the Shulchan Aruch, the basically accepted opinion is like the Rambam, that may say Akum are not metameh ba'ohel. So it's usually assumed, therefore it should have been permissible for the Kohen to come in contact with may say Akum ba'ohel. But then in the Shulchan Aruch, they recommend, nonetheless, even though that's the Ikra Din, we recommend the Kohen should not come in contact with Mesim Nochrim, even Ba'ohel. Why not? No, it says, a Kohen should be careful not to go in a non-Jewish cemetery because of the Ohel. So why not? So they give three explanations for this recommendation. One explanation is that there's usually a Jew who is buried in every non-Jewish cemetery, there's always going to be a Jew. A non-observant Jew who is buried there. So the Jew is Matami Bohel. So a Kohen should not go into a non-Jewish cemetery because there probably will be a Jewish mace there. Others say not only a non-Jewish cemetery because there may be a Jewish mace. Even if there's one non-Jewish body in the room, the Kohen should not come into the room because it should be Machmer, like Tosfos' opinion. Tosfos' Paskin is like the majority opinion of the Tanoim. That may say Yaakov, non-Jewish dead bodies, or Metami Bohel. The Rambam paskens like the Tana Rab Shimon Bayechoi. The non-Jews are not Metami Bohel. And Tosfos seems to pasken like the Chachamim, that may say Yaakov, are Metami Bohel. Then there's a third explanation that's given. It's interesting. It's given by two brothers-in-law, Rab Chaim Oizer and Rab Elchanan Wasserman. They were married to two sisters. They married the two daughters of the rabbi in Shavel. Shavel is a pretty big city. They travel through Europe. So it takes around 45 minutes. When the bus starts going through Shavel, it takes 45 minutes to get from one end of the city to the other. Pretty big city there. And the bus is going fast. So they were brothers-in-law. They both came up with the same idea to explain a difficult passage in the Rokeach. The Rokeach is one of the later Bali HaTosfos. So the Shach people don't usually sit and read the Rokeach, but the Shach in Yerideya quotes this Rokeach. So there's a strange passage in the Rokeach that the Magen Avraham quotes in the Yesan. So they both explain the same thing. The Rokeach seems to think a kohen is not permitted to come in contact with a mace, even if the mace is not metamehim. It's a din not to come in contact with dead bodies. So even if the mace akum is not metame bohel, but still, if you're going to be in the same room with the mace akum, you're coming in contact with the mace, even if it's not metame. So the question is, when you go to medical school, the ruba of the medical schools insist that you have to take a course in anatomy and you have to dissect dead bodies. You have to handle a dead body. So even if you have your charusa handle a dead body, I'll just look on, it's going to be tumas ohel. So if it's mace yakum, if you only have one mace, so you have in America, so you have a right to follow the roif. The majority, the overwhelming majority, the Jews are less than 1% of the world population. We get more than 25% of the Nobel Awards, but we're only much less than 1% of the world population. We have contributed way more to the world than our share. We have improved the world way more than 0.5%. We have improved the world way more than 25%. As a footnote. Okay. So, if you only have one mace in the room, so you have a right to assume that the likelihood is that it's going to be a mace akum. But if you have a class in anatomy, and you have 100 students, you have 100 cadavers there, 100 were less than 1%. Maybe the odds are still that all 100 are. If you have 200 dead bodies, the odds probably are that there is a Jewish body. Here in Eretz Yisrael, years ago, in all of the medical schools, they used to do, all the cadavers were Arab bodies. They used to kill so many terrorists, so they used to have a cater only dead bodies from Nigeria. Now they feel that this is a bizoyan, so the government doesn't allow that anymore. So they do work on Jewish bodies, which is not only a problem for the Kohanim, it's a problem for the non-Kohanim as well. Because there's a din that a Jewish mace is also b'hanor. You're not allowed to get hanor from a dead body. So if you deal with a dead body in order to learn anatomy, so you're getting hanor from the dead body. Secondly, it's an iser of nivala mace, you're cutting up the body. And thirdly, it's a bitla mitzvah of kvura. These are the three considerations why you're not supposed to use a Jewish body. So here it's not a problem. I have a son-in-law. I have three daughters who live in Eretz Yisrael. So one of my sons-in-law, after having six children, decided he wants to become a doctor. So he goes to Haifa Medical School. He lives in Ranana. He travels to Haifa every day to the medical school. So he tells me that they insist now, they don't allow them to have only Arab bodies. All the bodies are Jewish bodies. So it's a problem for the Jewish dude. Problem for the non-Kohanim also, not just a problem for the Kohanim. Not allowed to deal with it. So those who refuse to deal with the Jewish bodies, so they give you an exemption. They allow you to get your degree in medicine without doing work on the dead body. So the question, how good a doctor is he going to be later on? If you never really dealt with a real body, who's just doing online or something, that's going to be a problem. But that's the issue with the Kohanim in medical school. It's an issue with Kohanim visiting a sick person in a hospital. If it's an ear, nose, throat hospital, you assume there probably not going to be any dead bodies there. So there's probably not going to be a shiloh of the Kohen entering, unless there may be an issue that they have an Eivim and Achai. If they remove an organ from a live person, it's also metamik emes, and the kohen is not permitted to come in contact with an eivim menachai. But if you have a regular hospital where they have cancer patients and other people, and every day people are dying, so every day there are dead bodies there. So it's a shaila where the kohen is permitted to enter a hospital. So that before he enters the hospital, he has to get someone learned, someone who knows the halachas, to figure out the layout of the hospital, to figure out where the cancer ward whether that, whether when someone dies in the cancer ward, any other floor, so where do they take the dead body? How long does it stay on that floor? In which elevator do they take it? And where is the morgue? And where is the exit from the morgue? And which rooms are interconnected and so on? So that's a shaila stama of a kohen entering into a hospital. A lot of times that's a problem. Kohen medical school is always a problem. I remember years ago when I first got married, I moved into the neighborhood of Washington Heights. That's where the yeshiva is. So I moved into one side of Washington Heights is Breuer's community. The other side is Yeshiva University. Up the hill and down the hill. See, Breuer's not allowed to say Yeshiva University. So they say, oh, you're going up the hill. It's like you're nice. Not allowed to say the name of an Abu Dazar. Oh, you teach up the hill. So I live down the hill. I live in Breuer's down the hill. So there was a Kohen from Breuer's who decided he wants to go to medical school. So Rabbi Schwab told him he's not allowed to. Rabbi Schwab was the rabbi after Rabbi Breuer passed away. The last years he was the assistant rabbi with Rabbi Breuer. After Rabbi Breuer passed away, he was the rabbi. So the guy said he's going to go to medical school anyway because he heard that Rabbi Gorin had a heter. Rabbi Gorin wrote a heter. It's a very, very difficult heter, very controversial heter. I don't think it's correct. I published a whole essay explaining. I didn't quote by name Rabbi Gorin. I quoted what he said. I explained why I don't think it's correct. So this fellow said he's going to follow Rabbi Gorin. He's not going to listen to Rabbi Schwab. So Rabbi Schwab at that time, he asked Rabbi Moshe Feinstein to please write a tshuva, his opinion. So Moshe wrote him a handwritten tshuva, and they sent out a copy of the handwritten tshuva to all the members of Breuer's Kehillah. And that tshuva later was printed in his volume of the Igros Moshe, where he says, even if someone brilliant will be able to come up with a dreidel, with a kula, to allow a kohen to go to medical school, it's a bizoyan ha-Torah to come up with such a heter, because for so many centuries it was always assumed that it's prohibited. That's exactly the lashon that Rav Soloveitchik said. It was one of the students in yeshiva who wanted to go to medical school. He was a kohen. And he said, Rabbi Gorin has a heter. So Rav Soloveitchik said, I don't know what the heter is. He says, it's a bizoyan ha-Torah to find the heter for such a thing that for so many generations was assumed to be us. It's a problem. It's a problem. Is why you modern Orthodox? It's an interesting question. What does it mean, modern Orthodox? So, modern Orthodox, at first glance, is a contradiction in terms. The difference between the Orthodox and the other brands of Judaism, the main difference is that we believe in the 13 principles of faith of the Rambam, and the main one that's the issue, some of the others don't believe in God. Okay, the Jewish, they don't believe in God. But leaving that out, the main difference between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox is that Iker and Amunah, that principle of faith that the Rambam postulates, the laws of the Torah are immutable and they never change. So the other brands of Judaism believe that the laws can change. So if we, the Orthodox, stand for this position, we're obstinate and insistent on it, that the laws of the Torah don't change. So what does it mean, modern? Modern means you update everything. Modern just means you wear a short jacket as opposed to a long jacket. You have short pants as opposed to long pants. Modern means you update the observance of religion. That's the opposite from Orthodox. Orthodox, by definition, means Shazal Satara Lo Sehim Ochlefes. So the answer is, how can you ever have such a concept as modern Orthodox? So the answer is, the laws of the Torah never change, but the world keeps on changing. When you have the laws of Basa B'Cholov, so it says, under these circumstances, when you cook the milk with the meat, it's muta b'achila. If you have shishim, muta b'achila. Sometimes it's osa b'achila, muta b'hano. Sometimes it's osa b'hano, different cases. So you have many simonim and many seifim. You look in Shulchan Aruch, you have many chapters and many sections within each chapter of the Shulchan Aruch. You have many, many cases. If it's under these circumstances, otah, those circumstances is muta. So the same is true regarding all the laws. Shabbos, Kashrus, Taras, HaMashpach, everything. You have so many details. So the laws of the Torah never change, but the world keeps on changing. So what seems to be the exact same Shaila that we had yesterday, today, is not the exact same Shaila. There's so many differences and nuances. So since it's a different Shaila, maybe there's a different answer. So that's what modern Orthodox means. You look through the tshuvas of Rav Moshe Feinstein, or any tshuva sefer, the Rebbe Yehuda Chasam sefer, all the tshuvas from the beginning to the end. What are all the tshuvas all about? So most of them are not coming to come up with a new Shaila. They're coming up with the same old dinim that appear in the Gemara. The question is whether the din is still the same under the new circumstances, Maybe because of new circumstances, maybe a different sif should apply. Instead of sif aleph, maybe sif hey should apply. Sif aleph says asa, sif hey says mutter. Or sif aleph says mutter, sif hey says asa. What used to be mutter for so many years, maybe it's asa now. I remember when we were learning Yeridaya, someone just asked me this yesterday. I already forgot who. Oh yeah, on the telephone, in the car. Someone asked me this, that we were learning Yeridaya, so it says, if you have a pot that's treif, and it gets mixed in with other pots, so you have two kosher pots and one treifer pot, so do you say bittel beroiv or not? So you ought to say bittel beroiv. But the question is, it's a dovah sheyesh lematirin. You can kasher two hagolah on all three pots. So there's a din, a dovah sheyesh lematirin does not become bittel beroiv. So the Shulchan Aruch says that this is not called the dovah sheyesh lematirin because tzorach lehoitzi olav haitzos. It's going to cost money to kasher the pot. How much money is going to cost to kasher the pot? So we were learning this in class. Rabbi Soloveitchik said it doesn't apply today. So we're looking at why it doesn't apply. He said, how many of you ever visited Tzfat? Nobody. That time nobody had visited Tzfat. Years ago, it wasn't so. That was before they had the system that everybody comes to learn in Eretz Yisrael. So he says, I was there in Tzfat. He was there in 1935. He was there in Tzfat. He says, Tzfat is on top of a hill, and they have no running water. So you have to pay the Arabs to schlep the water from the ground. So of course, the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, lived in Tzfat. And it costs money. You have to pay the Arabs for the money, for the water, to kasher the pot. In America, he turned on the faucet. It doesn't cost any money. What tzorach lahotzi olav haitzos? The din doesn't apply today. Today it is a dovah sheyesh lematirin, and therefore it's not batel. So he's taking the din of Shulchan Aruch, he's explaining that din is correct, but because we live under different circumstances, by us it's a dovah sheyesh lematirin. Every single shaila that comes up, there's always something a little different from the way it used to be. So that's what the Rabbanim wrote all the tshuvas. Not Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was the famous one in our generation. All of the Rabbanim, so all the tshuvas about all the generations, they're all judging on the same issue. Because circumstances are different today, does the difference in circumstance mean that it's such a different shaila, so therefore you deserve a different tshuva, a different psak? Oh no, the din is still the same as it always used to be. Sometimes you have to change the din lahakil, sometimes you have to change the din lahachman. Just Ramash Yafash and tshuvas are all like that. Just for example, the Gemara has a din that the kohen has to get the first aliyah. What if the kohen is moichel on his kavod? They have a bar mitzvah, whatever, they have an oifruf. Have 2 yard sight and whatever on a Monday, Thursday, 2 yard sight. So strictly speaking, the kohen has the right to be moichel on his kavod. So then the Gemara says, but mid the rabbanon, we don't permit the kohen to be moichel on his kavod because he's going to cause machloikas. 1 week he's going to be moichel for Pliny. Next week someone else has yard sight. He's not going to be moichel for him. So the other guy is going to be angry. How come last week you were moichel your kavod for him and today you weren't moichel your kavod for me? So they made a takana that the kohen should never be moichel on his kavod. So then the Gemara says, when is that? That's only on Shabbos and Yom Tov when the shul is crowded. So everybody's going to see he was moichel on his kavod. In Sheni Machamishi, the shul is pretty empty. It isn't so crowded. So then he can be moichel on his kavod. We follow the din d'oraisa. So Tosfos writes on the Gemara, by us, there's no difference between Shabbos and the weekdays. The shul is just as crowded on the weekdays as it is on Shabbos. Because in the days of the Baalei HaTosfos, the communities were so tiny. The Crusaders killed a lot of Jews in the days about that. They wiped out a lot of communities, but the communities had 15 people. That was the whole community. There were hardly anybody there. There weren't so many Jews in the community. Tosfos talks in one place in Erevan about a community. There's only one Jewish family in the whole community. There's a big wall around the city, and everybody, all the citizens of the city are non-Jews, and there's only one Jewish family, so you don't even have to make an Erev. The wall is the Mechitza, and the Goyim don't ask, unless you have two Jewish families who ask around each other, then you have to rent from the Goyim. But if you only have one Jewish family in the whole building, one Jewish family in the whole city, then you don't have to rent from the Goyim. So in the days of the Baalei HaTosfos, there was such a Hechetimsa, one Jewish family in the whole city. So Tosfos says, by us, the communities are so tiny, the shul is just as crowded on the weekdays as it is on Shabbos, so the din applies both on the weekdays and on Shabbos. So that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. We don't allow the kohen to be moichel on his kavod even on Sheni Mechamish. So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says, but bizman hazeh, bizman hazeh. We reverted back to the minhag of the days of the Gemara, the holy minhag of the days of the Gemara, that the shul is half empty on the weekdays. It's only crowded on Shabbos and Yom Tov. So we revert back to the din and the Gemara, that on Sheni Mechamish, the kohen can be moichel on his kavod. All the tshuvas of all the Meshivim, throughout all the generations, that's what all the tshuvas are all about. to update the halachas to determine. The dinim of the Torah don't change, but the mitzvahs, the world keeps on changing. So you have to determine whether the psak that we always had for so many generations, does it still apply bisman hazeh or not? Says, why are you modern Orthodox? I think Rav Moshe Feinstein is modern Orthodox. I think, what does it mean modern Orthodox? Modern Orthodox means you have to follow the traditions of your parents, but a lot of times carrying over from Europe to America, because circumstances are so different, so following in the tradition means something different. Doesn't mean to do exactly the same.
I'm confused. If you say that in regards to your example of Moshe and all these cases, why was Moshe and the Rav so against Rav Goren, who's relating to a totally different Mitzvah? We haven't had a state of Israel, a Jewish state, in 2 millennia. So Rav Goren was actually relating to a whole new Mitzvah. In regards to Kohanim, when Rav Goren is relating to Kohanim going to medical school, that also is a different Mitzvah. So if you disagree, to say, you know, Chad B'Chalak, how can you monitor it, given the fact that for many generations we said it was Usser, but for many generations we didn't have a Jewish state. So it's a very different Mitzvah.
The Jewish state, I don't think, plays a role whatsoever as far as dead bodies are concerned. How does that affect the dead bodies in the Kohen?
Well, whether it does or doesn't, my impression was that it's just Ramosha. Ramosha said that it's, you know, possible to even bring up a possible head there. Where Goren was waiting to see us that we've never had medical schools which were totally controlled by Jews, which were all the doctors practicing there and all the students learning there were Jews, and in which case we have a place where we can't get non-Jewish bodies so easily. So I think Goren was trying to relate to a totally different Mitzvah than they ever had in Europe.
But Goren wrote the head to people in America. It had nothing to do with the Medina. People in America asked him this. I couldn't permit it to go to medical school. So he came up with an idea. His head had nothing to do with the Medina. His head had nothing to do with the fact that it's the Jewish medical school and most of the students are Jewish. The head was a fancy head to Api Halacha. He came up with a head to white side. Well, it was always mutter. It was always mutter for the Kohen with a dreidel, with a whole kunst to go to medical school. Nah, it has nothing to do. He came up with a head to, I'll tell you, Regalachas. If you wear a metal watch and you attend a funeral, so the metal watch becomes tummy to the same level as the mace itself. That's called Cherev Harei Kochol. It's Avi Avoy Satum. And in Shulchan Aruch there's a machlokes, and we pass in Shulchan Aruch that it's permissible for a Kohen to come in contact with a Cherev Harei Kochol. So he says, let a non-Kohen attend a funeral. Let him wear a watch. And then let him give the watch to the Kohen. The Kohen will wear the watch on his arm. So the Kohen is permitted to come in contact with the Cherev Harei Kochol. So then, once the Kohen is holding on to the Cherev Harei Kochol and he touches a dead body, it's not Moisef Tum Al Tumasa. So this dreidel was good for the last 2,000 years, and it was never accepted. No one ever did it. Obviously, it's incorrect. And there are good reasons why it's incorrect. Has nothing to do, his head had nothing to do with the fact that you have a Jewish Medina with a Jewish medical school.
Excuse me, I don't want to take too much time from the student's question, but I think Rabbi Berman was referring to a different Shiva of the program. Referring to autopsies. Mitzvotim.
Ah.
So, and Sri Dayesh and Rav Goren both tell that the need for medical schools in the state of Israel is a halachic consideration to be somewhere from the Mekelin with regard to autopsies. I think this is what Rabbi Berman meant.
Okay.
And then the question is valid.
Okay. Good. Is that a different question?
No.
I'm not familiar at all with that. Okay.
Would you consider it more than autopsies?
Certainly is a consideration. You live in a different world. It may be relevant, may not be relevant, but it certainly is a different story. Certainly is a different story. The Chassam Sofer writes in one of his letters, "Bavinisenu Harabim, we don't have a Jewish medical school." He writes, and all of our knowledge of medicine is based on autopsies done to non-Jewish bodies, and the Talmud raises a possibility that maybe the Jewish body functions differently from the non-Jewish body because we eat different food, we keep kosher, and we do mitzvahs, the Gemara and Shabbos says. So he says, maybe all of the medicine that was learned from the autopsies in the non-Jewish body maybe doesn't carry over to Jewish bodies. That's the expression of Bava. In the same Haram, we don't have a Jewish medical school. You have a Jewish medical school, so maybe everything is different, Tak. A lot of things could be different. You have to research it. There could well be. Has Tcheles been rediscovered? Well, in the late 1800s, there was a prominent Hasidic Rebbe, the Radzina Rebbe, who is a big learner. He published the Sidrei Taharos. He composed a Talmud on Mishnayos Taharos. He took the Mishnayos and he collected all the Gemaras all over Shas. Not that difficult. You look at the Masoras HaShas. He collected, but he did it. So he collected all the Gemaras and he wrote a fake Gemara. He put the Mishnayos and he took all the Gemaras from all over. He put it and he wrote like a Rashi and a Tosfos on the side. And the Rabbanim of his generation were afraid people are going to think it's a real Gemara, so they insisted he should put on the top of every page Sidrei Taharos. They should all know that this is an imitation Gemara. Like there's I have such a Gemara on Pirkei Avos. Someone took all the Gemaras in Shas and Yerushalmi and they organized it so they have a Mishnah and a Gemara and a Mishnah and a Gemara, just like a regular Talmud Bavli, Maseches Avos with a Talmud. So this Hasidic Rebbe is a very learned Rebbe. Has a lot of chidushim in Taharos. So he felt that we have to prepare for the coming of Mashiach and prepare for the rebuilding of the Beis Hamikdash. So he felt the Kohanim can only bring the Karbonis and Beis Hamikdash if they're wearing their special uniforms. They have to wear special Big Day Kohuna. And part of the Big Day Kohuna requires that it should have Tchelas. And even though in the Tzitzis, the accepted opinion in the Gemara, there's a dispute among the Tanaim, the accepted view is that the Tchelas is not Mi'akedes. For so many centuries we've been wearing Talesim without any Tchelas. So the din is that you yotze the mitzvah of Tzitzis in an incomplete form, even though you don't have the Tchelas. But in the Big Day Kuhuna, it says explicitly in the Tosefta that all the Tanaim agree that the Tchelas is Mi'akedes. If you don't have those Big Day Kuhuna dyed with the Tchelas color that it's supposed to have, so then the Big Day Kuhuna are not acceptable, and the Kohanim cannot offer the Karbonis in the Beis Hamikdash. So this Radzina Rebbe felt, if we'll prepare for the building of the Beis Hamikdash, then the Rebbe Shlomo he'll do his half. We have to start, and he'll finish. We're not going to start, we're just going to sit back, so the Rebbe Shlomo is not going to do anything. So he felt we have to rediscover the Tchelas. So he was a genius. So he heard that there's a big aquarium in Italy. He traveled to Italy, and he learned how to speak Italian. And he went through the aquarium, and he decided which fish is the chalazon. The din is that the tchelas has to be a specific color, and has to come from a specific sea animal. So he decided that this is the right one. So years later, the one who later became Rabbi Herzog, who later became the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, when he lived in Ireland, he went to university and his doctoral dissertation was on this topic, on Tchelas. So he wrote there that, a whole long story, that the chemist in Italy fooled the Chassidish Rebbe and he gave him a different, the Rebbe decided that this fish, the squid fish, and the dye that it spits out, the black dye that it spits out, that's the Tchelas. And when he tried to dye, when the Rebbe tried to dye the wool in this black color, so it kept on washing out. And the Gemara says the way to know that it's authentic Tchelas is that the color holds fast, that you can't wash it out. So he didn't know what to do. He thought that this is the Chalazon and this is the Tchelas, it keeps on washing out. So he put an advertisement in the Italian newspapers, he needs the assistance of a chemist, he's prepared to pay money. So a non-Jewish chemist came and said, for money I'll be happy to help you out, what do you need? So he explained, he needs a chemical that should cause this dye to hold fast, and he explained he needs this color for religious purposes. He said, no problem. He gave him a chemical and it worked. So Rabbi Herzog wrote in his dissertation, it didn't work. He said he tested the Radzina Tchelas and it doesn't have anything min hachai. The non-Jewish chemist gave the Radzina Rebbe Prussian blue, a chemical Prussian blue, that gave the color that he wanted. And all the dye that came from the squid fish all washed out. And the whole color in the wool was from the chemical. It wasn't from the fish at all. So Rabbi Herzog wrote that was a big mistake. So Rabbi Herzog then, in his dissertation, explains that in Talmudic Hebrew, the word chalazon doesn't mean a fish. It means a shell animal. And he shows many midrashim and passages in Talmud. The word chalazon is not a fish. It's a shell. It's a worm in a shell. And then he says, if you look in the museums and you find out how many shelled animals are there in the Mediterranean that give this color blue, there's only one. By process of elimination, there's only one. So he identified which it is. So then at the end of the last five, ten pages in his dissertation, he backs out from that because he sent a letter to the curator of some museum in Paris, and he asked, instead of testing it himself, he asked the curator of the museum whether this dye from that murex trunculus, from this shelled animal, whether that's a fast color or that'll also wash out. So the fellow from Paris wrote him, the non-Jew from the Paris Museum wrote him that that'll wash out. That color doesn't hold. So he said, so it's no good for Tchelis. Tchelis has to be that it holds color and it can't wash it out. So he switches and he says it must be a different sea animal, a different thing that has a shell, and it's a different color. It's purple. If it's purple, that's argomen. This Tchelis and argomen are two different things. So we usually assume Tchelis is blue, and argomen is purple. So he says, no, they're both purple, and this is in the wintertime. Sometime, but he gives the whole doichik in the end of the book. So now you have, there's one professor here in Eretz Yisrael who follows Chief Rabbi Herzog. So he sells trailers in the stores, purple, from a different shell animal in the Mediterranean. And most do not follow this Professor Ziederman. They followed the suggestion that Rabbi Herzog made that he rejected in the last 10 pages because what the curator in the museum sent them was a mistake. The dye that comes from this, the blue dye that comes from this murex trunculus, from this shelled animal, is a fast color and it does not wash out. In fact, Rabbi Tendler from Yeshiva University, who's the one who wound up these guys to go scuba diving, to get these shelled animals. There's a dentist here in Eretz Yisrael, Ari Greenspan, and he has his chevra Zivitovsky with what's the other guy's name?
Sturman.
The whole chevra who goes scuba diving. They're the ones who started this whole trailers industry in Eretz Yisrael. So they're all wound up by Rabbi Tendler. So Rabbi Tendler said he tested this trailers that they have now, the blue trailers. And he says he soaked the tzitzis that were dyed with trailers in Clorox for a week. And he says that the color didn't come out. Didn't come out at all. Not only does that wash out in water, even with Clorox it doesn't come out. So that's what many assume, that it's at least a suffix, at least a suffix, that maybe this is the correct trailers. Maybe it's even vadai that this is the correct trailers. I thought that if it's at least a suffix, so at least suffix, they're right, so the chumer. The reason why some are hesitant to use it is because when the Hasidish Rebbe, when the Radzina Rebbe came up with his trailers, so he first published the whole sefer, why he thinks this is the correct trailers. Then he published the second and the third sefer. Now they print all three together. It's called Shloshes Sefer HaTchelis. So in the second volume that he published all of the comments, all of the reactions that the Rabbonim had towards his discovery. So some said yes, some said no, they agreed, they disagreed. Everybody had something else to say. Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan had something unusual to say. Everybody had something to say. So he has a letter from an unidentified Talmud Chacham, who writes that he's very close to the Rabbi of Brisk, Rabbi Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik, that was the father of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, the one who wrote the Beis Halevi. So he writes in the name of the Rabbi in Brisk, of Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik, he's opposed to the trailers that he discovered because you identified the halazon as the squid fish. He says, my father and my grandfather knew that the squid fish spits off this black color dye, and they didn't use the squid fish. So it's like we have a tradition that you're wrong. If you come up with a new fish that our parents were not aware of, I'll be happy to go along with you. But you can't tell me that the squid fish is the halazon. We have a masorah that you're wrong. That's how the unidentified Talmud Chacham says in the name of Rabbi Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik. The Soloveitchik family, both in America and here in Eretz Yisrael, they have a different version of what the Beis Halevi said. So their version is that even if you're right, you're not right because you have to have a masorah to identify what the halazon is. That's totally in opposition to what the letter says. The letter that this unidentified Talmud Chacham said, if you come up with a new fish that was unknown to our forefathers, I'll be happy to wear the trailer, but you tell me this squid fish, we have a masorah that you're wrong, because my parents or grandparents knew of the existence of the squid that it spits off the black dye, and they never used it. So that's the question, which of the two versions make more sense? So in recent years, someone, Rabbi Feivel Cohen from New York, asked Rabbi Al-Yashiv, which of the two versions make more sense to him? So he said, it doesn't make sense to him. You have to have a tradition. If you can discover, based on archaeology, based on dictionaries, based on whatever, if you can rediscover what the halazon is, why should you need a masorah? He thinks the other version makes more sense. So then Rabbi Feivel Cohen asked him, so what do you say about the new trailer? So he said, he has to think about it. Okay, he's not sure, he has to think about it. So, I would think, my humble opinion, I think that it's at least a suffix. So if the Torah gives us an opportunity to fulfill a mitzvah, and you have a possibility, so that's a principle of suffix deraisa l'chum. If it's a suffix, you should fulfill a mitzvah. So one of the G'dolim came up with a chiddush, an interesting chiddush, that suffix deraisa l'chum only applies if a person shook a lulavan and esrog in the morning of Sukkot, and he's doubtful whether the esrog was kosher or not, maybe it was pasul, so we tell him, shake again, we safek, and now you know for sure that you fulfilled the mitzvah. So then you say, safek, deraisa l'chumra, do the mitzvah again, to be positive, to know for sure. But if you have a safek, if this is trelis, and even if you use a trelis, you'll still be in the same safek, you still won't know whether he did the mitzvah. So some suggested that maybe safek deraisa l'chumra shouldn't apply in such a situation. So this suggestion was dealt with by a prominent Polish goyim before he was killed by the Nazis in the Warsaw Ghetto, Rabbi Menachem Zemba. And he quotes this, and he shows there were poskim who said like that, and he said that's not the accepted opinion of Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says black and white that safek deraisa l'chumra even applies in a situation where after you'll do it, you still won't be sure whether you fulfill the mitzvah. You still obligated misafek to try misafek to do the mitzvah. If it's possible that doing this act constitutes a mitzvah, so you should do it. Can a woman be appointed a rabbi in a community? Interesting, Shaila. There was a prominent scholar in the Jewish Theological Seminary, Professor Shaul Lieberman. So when the seminary started to give smicha to women, so he was so upset, so he wrote a letter to his colleagues. This is ridiculous. Even though Taisus has two opinions, whether women can have smicha, Taisus and Baba Kama and Taisus and Gittin has two opinions. When you make a bezin of three, to make a din Torah, is there a din that only men have smicha, only men can be members of the bezin? Maybe women can have smicha also. They can also be members of the bezin. So there's two opinions in the Shulchan Aruch. So he writes, but that's ridiculous. No one ever followed that opinion in the Taisus. Everybody knows that you don't give smicha to women. So he says it's utterly ridiculous. I don't know, no one knows exactly why did it bother him so much. The people in the seminary who used to get the ordination, many of them didn't observe Shabbos, they didn't observe Taras HaMishpacha. Why did it bother him so much? Why is the smicha for the women worse than all the other things that were going on in the seminary for so many years? But he went out of his kelim, he went wild. So he wrote this letter, and it's available in print. He was opposed to giving smicha to the women. The reason why it's usually assumed that it's not proper to have a woman serve as a rabbi in a synagogue is mishum tznius. What does it mean, tznius? So people make a mistake. A lot of people think that tznius means that the women have to wear a dress down to here and a neck up to here and a dress down to there. That may be part of, I don't know, down to here. That's part of tznius. That's part of tznius. I'm just reminded now as I'm speaking, Reb Benny Eisner just passed away. He was a Rebbe of thousands of students here in Eretz Yisrael. So he told that he was very kofof to his Rebbe of Tzvi Yehuda Cook. So he said he has a few daughters, Reb Benny Eisner. So he said when they were young, so he was always learning. He never made so much of a living. So his relatives in Canada once sent beautiful dresses for the little girls when they were 4 years old or something. And the dresses had short sleeves, puffy short sleeves. Now little girls wear dresses like that. So they were all dressed up, l'kavod yontif. And he drove them to the home of Reb Tzvi Yehuda Cook. They should get it. They should go inside and ask for a bracha from his Rebbe, Reb Tzvi Yehuda Cook. So he was waiting in the car outside. So the girls went in, and then they ran out and they were crying. So he said, what's the matter? So he said, they said, Reb Tzvi Yehuda Cook was angry at them. What do you mean angry? He never gets angry. He didn't give them a bracha. He was angry. So he didn't know what to do. So he parked the car and he went in and he said, what's the matter? So he said, they're coming with such short dresses. The little girl is 4 years old. Not allowed to wear such short dresses. So he said, how long did the sleeves have to be? He said, Kimo Nechama. Apparently Nechama Lieberman. What's her name? Leibowitz. Nechama Lieberman. Apparently she used to wear dresses all the way down to him. He said, Kimo Nechama. Has to be down to the... Okay. That's So people make a mistake. They think tznius means that the women have to dress properly. That's one part of the concept of tznius. Tznius means the following. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us all B'Tzelem Elokim. All people were created B'Tzelem Elokim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands the Jewish people, B'Halach the Bedrocho, we should preserve the Tzelem Elokim that we have. We should go in the ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to preserve that Tzelem Elokim. We shouldn't be mekalkalim. So what are the midas of Elokus that are included in B'Halach the Bedrocho? So the Talmud tells us, Mahu Chanun, Apatochan, Mahu Racham, Mahu Kavramesim, Mahu Mevakacheilim, and so on and so forth. How do we know what are the ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? We can philosophize till, from today till next day. We'll never be able to figure out how God runs His world. So the Rambam says, the prophets, the Nevi'im tell us, you study the Torah, the Nevi'im Aksuvim, it tells us how HaKadosh Baruch Hu acts. And it's relevant for us. That's how we know what's the definition of Tzelem Elokim and how we're supposed to act to preserve the Tzelem Elokim that was implanted within all of us when we were born. So the Novi Yeshaya tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a kel mistater. He hides. He's invisible, and he does such a good job at hiding, there's so many people who don't even believe that he's there. He does a very good job at hiding. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands us, once in a long while, he makes a gilui shechina. On the occasion of Makkas B'Chairas, there was a gilui shechina. On the occasion of Mamre HaSina, there was a gilui shechina. But most of the time, 99% of the time, he's a kel mistater, and he hides. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu implanted within all of us at Tzelem Elokim, and to preserve that Tzelem Elokim, we're always supposed to act the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu acts. We're supposed to imitate the ways of God, not to imitate, to try to become someone whom we are not. When a person tries to imitate someone else, he's going to have a nervous breakdown. It means you should preserve the Tzelem Elokim that you do have already. That's how the pasuk reads, V'halachta b'drochov, in Parshas Kisov, and then the next pasuk reads, V'ro kolami horis. When all the nations of the world will realize Shem Hashem Nikra Alecha, you have succeeded in preserving your Tzelem Elokim, Shem Hashem Nikra Alecha, V'yoru Mimeko, they will learn from you how to act with Yerushamayim. That's how the Vilna Gaon and other commentaries translate the Pashut Pshat and the Pasuk. The idea behind V'halach the Bedrochov is not to imitate the ways of God, to try to become something that we are not. How can we become God? It means to preserve Shem Hashem Nikra Lacha, to preserve the Tzelem Elokim that we already have. So the Novi Yishai tells us that one of the midas of Elokus is Tznius. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a kel mistater. So he wants everyone to try to lead an anonymous life, to try to do everything but tzina. Not just to cover the body, men and women, not just to dress properly. A personal dress with an orange, a bright red polo shirt, a bright orange shirt to draw attention. So that's a violation. It's needless. Even a person is fully dressed like Nechama, down to here and down to there. Huh? But if you're drawing attention to yourself, a person walks into a shul, goes all the way up to the front. Everybody should see that I'm here. On the base manager, everybody's running. He screams on top of his lungs. Everybody should know that I'm here. I want to get attention. So that's a violation of tznius. So the Mesillas Yesharim gives a description. A guy wants to draw attention, so he's so humble. So he walks in, he always sits in the back row. Sits in the back row in order to draw attention. Everybody's sitting in the front, and he sits all in the back. So sometimes that's also to draw attention. People do a lot of things to draw attention. So all of this is a violation of tznius. So the Ribbono Shel Olam wants everyone to preserve their Tzelem Elokim by acting in a fashion of mistater. Sometimes you have to. Ribbono Shel Olam sometimes does gilui shechina. Once in a while, he expects us also to do things b'farhesya. You have to have a president of the country. You have to have a rosh hamemshala. You have to have a chazan daven farnom. You have to have a rabbi. I'm speaking in public. I'm violating tznius. It's a clear violation of tznius. So the Torah says, "Sam tos malach melech," and the Tanoim have a comment in the Sifrei, "Melech v'lei malcha." Even when we require of people to violate tznius, to do things in public, So the Torah wants the women shouldn't have to violate. It's bad enough that the men have to compromise on etznias. Torah doesn't want that the women should have to violate on etznias. That's why it's usually assumed people always make the mistake. Etznias means that the women have to dress properly. Etznias applies to the men and to the women. But the Torah tells us it applies even more to the women. In the area of going public, that when you have to do things in public, but when you have to do things in public, like appoint a king, have a chazan daven for an omer, have a rabbi in the community, so that's melech v'lo malka. You shouldn't have a woman unless you have no choice. If the alternative is, there was a fine rabbi in New Jersey, where in his shul they were having elections for president of the shul. So there were two candidates. So one was a man, one was a woman. The man's platform was, if he gets elected, he's going to fire the rabbi. He didn't like the rabbi. He was the rabbi's orthodox rabbi. He didn't like the rabbi. He wanted to push to the left. And the woman who was running for president was normal. She didn't want to fire the rabbi. So the rabbi called her Baron Lichtenstein, and he explained to Shas that Baron Lichtenstein said, you're allowed to have a woman president under those circumstances in Moscow. Well, the rabbi will agree. If the alternative is, should you have a man president who wants to turn the shul to the left, a woman president who wants to maintain orthodox status of the shul. If you have no choice, so you do allow a woman. You have no choice. But whenever there's a choice, let's say to give a woman an aliyah, why do you have to give women an aliyah? Whoever gets an aliyah is in violation of tznius. He's doing something in public. Better would be that nobody should get an aliyah. Better should be that nobody should ever daven for an omer. What motivates the women to want to daven for an omer? What motivates women to get an aliyah? Because they want equal rights. The men always demand aliyahs. You're young, you don't know this. When you go to shuls, there's always some wise guy. He always has to get mafter. He has yahrzeit for his mother today. The next week he has yahrzeit for his grandmother. The next week he has yahrzeit for his uncle. The next week he has yahrzeit. And they won't let him, so go to another shul. He always has to get mafter. What does he get mafter? What? He wants to gurgle away. He wants to sing the mafter. Everybody should listen to me. So it's like he has the right to get on. He wants the daven for an omer. He has the right to daven for an omer. So the women want equal rights. So the whole thing is a mistake. The gaboim should never give him the right to daven for an omer so much. It's a violation of tznius. The guy wants to. If a person has yahrzeit, so we require of him he should daven for an omer. We require of him he should get an aliyah. Better should be that no one should ever get an aliyah. Whoever gets an aliyah, whoever davens for an omer, is in violation of tznius. But you have no choice. Someone has to get the aliyahs. So that's why the Gemara says, strictly speaking, a woman can get an aliyah. But it's a violation of kavarat zibur if the woman will get an aliyah. Why is it a violation of kavarat zibur? It means that there's nobody in the shul who can, there's no man in the shul who knows how to get an aliyah. But you had to cause the women to compromise on etznias. The halacha says it's bad enough that men have to compromise on etznias. Whoever gets the aliyah is compromising on etznias. We don't want the women to have to compromise on etznias. It belays brera. If the only alternative is, it's either going to be a male president who wants to fire the rabbi and push the shul to the left, or a female president, so then Belay's Berry, you have to compromise on the woman's knees and have her appointed as the president. But on the normal circumstance, so appointing the woman as the president was a violation of Kovenat Tzibur, but you have no choice. It's a busha to the Tzibur that the only alternative was a man wanted to turn the shul to the left and get rid of the rabbi. So under those circumstances, you had to have the woman compromise on her tznius. So if you insist a woman is going to get an aliyah, it's a violation of kavanat tzibur. It means that there's no man in the shul who knows how to get an aliyah. That you had to come l'dekach to have a woman violate her tznius, compromise on her tznius. So that's why it's usually assumed that it's improper for women to serve as a rabbi in a community. Because the rabbi in the community is a position of sorora. It's a public position. The rabbi is always compromising on his knees. Gets up. I'm compromising on my knees. I'm getting up and I'm speaking. This is so foreign to Americans. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say in different rushes, this is so foreign to the American way of thinking. He said, to quote his Lashon, in America, the way that people say is, you can write about me whatever you want, but make sure you put my picture in the paper and you spell my name correctly so everybody will know who I am. You can attack me, but make sure everybody knows who I am. Everybody in America wants publicity. He says the whole American attitude is totally in contradiction to the Jewish attitude. The Jewish attitude, everyone should try to lead a life of tznius, to lead a private life, as private as possible, as anonymous as possible, because We were all created Betzalem Elokim, and we should preserve that Tzalem Elokim. And one of the meters of Elokus is HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a Kel Mistater. It's hard to understand because we were all brought up in America. So the whole attitude in America is totally contradictory. Is there a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael today? Avnei Nezer was a great Hasidic Rebbe, a great Goyen, who died 100 years ago, about 100 years ago. And he has very beautiful tshuvas. He was a super genius. Every tshuva of his is something genius. He never has anything bland. Everything is always very sharp by him. So he has such a shaila. Is there a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael today? And if there is, how come the Gdolei HaChassidus never moved to Eretz Yisrael? That's the shaila. So the first half of the tshuva he explains there absolutely is a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, no doubt about it. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. Where is it in Shulchan Aruch? So it's interesting, where is it in the Shulchan Aruch? To find something in the Gemara, you have to remember where it comes from. The Gemara is not Mesudadik. The Gemara is not roughly it's an audi habs, right? But it's not Mesudadik. You learn Maseches Gittin, you think you know all there is to know about Gittin. There's one daf in Yuma and daf Yud Gimel that has Dinam of Gittin that never appear anywhere in Gittin. You learn any Mesichta, you learn there's always something in another Mesichta. That's what the Medrash comments on the Pasuk in Shir Hashirim. Mimerchak Tobi Lachman. There's always some Bikiyas from somewhere else far away that if you don't know that, you know Masechah Shabbos from cover to cover. But there's one Taisus in Sanhedrin and Daf Pei Dalet that doesn't appear anywhere in Shas. That Gemara doesn't appear, that Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Pei Dalet and the Taisus, it doesn't appear anywhere in Masechah Shabbos. A major detail in Hilchos Shabbos. So the Gemara is not at all Mesudadik. The Rambam did us a tremendous service. He took all these Gemaras and he put them all in order. So you don't have to remember anything. You want to find something in the Rambam, you use your logic and you look where it belongs. The Shulchan Aruch did us a favor and he took everything out of order. And he put everything into the order that appears in the Gemara, which is totally out of order. So the only way to find anything in the Shulchan Aruch is to know, to remember where it is in the Gemara. So if you want to find the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, it's in Ebenezer. Why is it in Shulchan Aruch Ebenezer? Ebenezer, that married life. Because the Mishnah, the end of Ksubis, discusses if a couple gets divorced, so does the husband have to pay Ksuba or not? So if they fell in love, and then they fell out of love, so the husband has to pay Ksuba. If the husband decided he wants to divorce his wife, he's at fault. He has to pay ksuba. If it's not at fault, no one's at fault. No fault divorce. The husband has to pay ksuba. But if he can establish that it's the wife's fault for ruining the marriage, she curses the in-laws all the time. Kalelis yolda befonov. Or she's cooking non-kosher food for the husband. She doesn't want to go to mikveh. She doesn't want to have any children. It means when they got married, it was assumed she is going to go to mikveh. If they got married, they weren't religious. And it was assumed she's not going to keep anything. Then the husband decides to become religious and he divorces her. He has to pay ksuba. But when they got married, it was assumed that they're going to observe Taras and Mishpach and going to observe Kashrus. And then she doesn't live up to the deal. So then she's at fault for ruining the marriage. So the Mishnah continues to discuss the case. The couple is married for 50 years. They live in Chutz Lartz. Then the husband has this crazy idea. He wants to go on Aliyah. He becomes a Zionist in his old age, the age of 75. After 50 years of marriage, he wants to go there itself. The wife says, what are you, crazy? All the children, all the grandchildren, everybody lives in America. All my brother and my sister, I don't want to move to Eretz Yisrael. Husband says, I'm going to divorce you. So she says, so divorce me. What can you do? So whose fault is it for ruining the marriage? I would have said, the husband, I'm a shugana. After living 50 years with the wife in America, and the whole family lives in America, all of a sudden it becomes a Zionist. He wants to move to Eretz Yisrael. So the Mishnah says, not so. The Mishnah says, whoever wants to move to Eretz Yisrael has the right position, and the one who refuses to go to Eretz Yisrael is at fault for ruining the marriage. So if the husband wants to move to Eretz Yisrael and the wife doesn't want to, husband has the right to divorce her without paying her the ksuba, because she's at fault for ruining the marriage. And then the Gemara has the whole discussion in the context of that Mishnah, how what it is to live in Eretz Yisrael. So because the Gemara has the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael, in the context of that Mishnah, that's where it's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. The Rambam does not have it in Hilchos Ishah. The Rambam has it where it belongs. living in Eretz Yisrael, where it belongs, in Hilchos Malachim. You can live wherever you want. It's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, and so on and so forth. So the Avnei Nezer has this long tshuva. It became a big issue. It was a controversial tshuva when it was published over 100 years ago. So he writes, there certainly is a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, and he explains why others made a mistake. And then the question was raised, how come the Gdolei HaChassidus never moved to Eretz Yisrael? So he says, there was no Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael in earlier years. He wrote the tshuva 100 years ago. Oh, he died 100 years ago. There was no Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. So what are the tzaddik going to do? A big Hasidic Rebbe from Europe should move to Eretz Yisrael. He'll be all by himself. He won't be able to teach Torah Hasidus to any Hasidim. The Hasidim who loved him will send money from Poland, from Europe, to support him in Eretz Yisrael. So he said, that's a partial mitzvah, to live in Eretz Yisrael, off of money that's sent from Chutz Lars. But he says, the main mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael is to have a hashpoah, to have an influence, to plant. A farmer who plants, a person who paves the highways, a person who works for the army, a person who works on the security of Medina, a person who works on the economics, a person who lives in Eretz Yisrael and he teaches Torah, he does something. Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael is not, he distinguishes, Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael means to live in Eretz Yisrael, and Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael means to improve the country. The tzaddikim are going to move to Eretz Yisrael, they won't be able, there's nothing to improve. It was run by non-Jews, there was no Jewish government. Before 1948, there was no Jewish, hardly any Jewish community here. So he says, if they'll move to Eretz Yisrael, they'll only be fulfilling a partial mitzvah, very incomplete mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. If they live in Chutz Lars, they'll be fulfilling the mitzvahs of having hashpoah, an influence on the balabatim. So this is the alternative. So it's a bigger mitzvah to have an influence on your balabatim. But today that you have a Jewish country, so whoever moves to Eretz Yisrael does something productive, unless you plan to live in Eretz Yisrael, live off of welfare. That's an ishke mitzvah. That's an shulchan aruch. A person should move to Eretz Yisrael and live off of charity. It's no mitzvah. The government won't want you to come. But it says in shulchan aruch that if you're not going to make a parnos in Eretz Yisrael, then that's not a mitzvah. Just to live in Eretz Yisrael, that's not a, it's a very impartial mitzvah. It's better to stay in Chutz Lars. So there certainly is a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. If it's a reasonable way of living, if it's going to be unreasonable, then there's no mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. We read in the Psukim, last week said and this week said, when there was a famine in Eretz Yisrael, and there's no food to eat, so you'll have to leave the Chutz Lars. If life is too difficult, if you can't make a parnasa, or there's no food to eat, then you're not allowed to move to Chutz Lars. I remember years ago, I was speaking in... I was speaking in Los Angeles for the OU, and then I go to Eretz Yisrael Yeshiva University. So I went on a plane from Los Angeles to New York to go to Eretz Yisrael. So the plane was delayed there in the airport in Los Angeles, around half an hour. So I see a guy goes from the business class all the way to the back to use the bathroom. He looked very familiar. I remember his face from the yeshiva. And then as he walked back to the business class, he says, "Hi, Rabbi, I'd been in my shir 40 years ago." So he tells me he was a doctor, what do you call a doctor who reads x-rays?
Radiologist.
He was a radiologist in Los Angeles. Tells me he made $2 million a year. I can't count such high numbers. Says made two, I don't know, maybe it's a guzman. He said he made $2 million a year. He's married, he has children. He was wearing tight, torn jeans and sneakers without any socks. So he says he was a cardiologist, a radiologist. And he made a fortune of money. And then he moved to Eretz Yisrael and he, with his family, he went on Aliyah and he moved to this poor suburb of Tel Aviv, what's called Savion, where the poor people live. And his wife, and he only makes $500,000 a year. I don't know, how does he make $500,000 a year in Eretz Yisrael? It's a moifus also. I don't know how he made $2 million there. That's what he's telling me. He says his wife can't get used to living in poverty, so he's going to have to move back to America. I was going to put my hand in my pocket, give him a $10 donation. He should buy a pair of socks. Then he didn't have any socks to wear. So if a person lives in Eretz Yisrael and he's miserable, he doesn't make a parnasa, or he's miserable. So then there's no mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael in misery. The Gemara says, there's so many wonderful yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. I'm being entertained now. They take me from yeshiva to yeshiva. I have such a hanah to visit all the yeshivas. Everybody's sitting and learning and talking. Learning is gevaldik. There's so many yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. let's say a guy is, he's in love with Lakewood, he's in love with YU, he has to go learn in Lakewood. There are 1,001 yeshivas, there are 5,000 yeshivas now. So he only is chalosh and he has to learn in Lakewood, has to learn in New York. So if he's going to be unhappy over here, so we allow him to go to America. He fell in love with a girl in America. There are not enough girls in Eretz Yisrael. He fell in love with a girl from Chutzlar. So the Gemara says, Lo matar v'leisa yishav, he's going to be miserable living in Eretz Yisrael. So all things are not equal. So we allow him to move to Chutzlar. But whenever it's reasonable to live in Eretz Yisrael on Chutzlar, so then it's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. If it's unreasonable, because he fell in love with the girl who lives there, we don't want to break his heart. And he fell in love with that yeshiva. There's so many yeshivas here. He wants the dafka learn over there. So little matar v'leisa yishav, he does make a parnasa here. Nebuch, he only makes $500,000 a year. Go back to America. He'll make a reasonable parnasa of the $2 million. He's allowed to go back to America. But normally there certainly is a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. There's the Chaya Yodam. Everybody knows the Chaya Yodam was the generation of the Vilna Gaon. He claims to be a mechutn of the Vilna Gaon. He was mechutn of the son of the Vilna Gaon. But he doesn't tell you the whole story. So, my mechutn the Vilna Gaon, he writes. I would also brag if I'd be a mechutn the Vilna Gaon. He delivered a hesped when the Vilna Gaon passed away. His mechutn the Vilna Gaon. So the Chayodim wrote a separate sefer on Hilchas Eretz Yisrael. So he writes all about the Trumas and Maisas, Shemitah, everything, all the mitzvah. Then he writes about the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. So he raises the issue. Is it permissible for children to move to Eretz Yisrael if the parents are upset? Kibbut Aviyim, the parents have nachas, they have Kibbut Aviyim, means you have to service your parents, you have to give them pleasure, you have to give them hanoah. So the parents have nachas, they see their children growing up and so on. Or the children get married, so they come and they visit every so often, or they send photographs of the children, whatever. If you're going to move to Eretz Yisrael, they're hardly going to see the parents at all. So it is a violation of Kibbut Aviyim. So he raises the issue. He's raised before him also. He raises the issue. Is that considered all things being equal? Maybe that's considered miserable. He's going to live in Eretz Yisrael. It's going to be a total violation of Kibbut Aviyim because he's never going to see. In the days of Chayodam, he's not going to be able to talk on Skype. He's not going to fly back and forth. They're not going to fly back and forth. He's never going to see the parents. I'll write them a couple of letters a couple of times a year. But there's going to be a real violation of Kibbut Aviyim. So he quotes a Medrash Rabbah in the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha Mi'artzecha, and you leave your father behind. Terach Avi Avram is still alive. So the Medrash says, I only allow you to violate Kibbut Aviyim, no one else. So he thinks that that's what it means. That only Avram Avinu was allowed to move to Eretz Yisrael in violation of Kibbut Aviyim, no one else is allowed to. And most of the other Mefarshim say that that's not what the Medrash Rabbah says. But that's a common shaila. I have 3 daughters who moved to Eretz Yisrael. My wife will never forgive them why they moved to Eretz Yisrael. My wife says, it's my fault. I'm always talking about Zionism. I told my wife, I talk about all the 613 mitzvahs equally. I give time for Shabbos and for Kashas and for Taras HaMishpacha and Mezuzah and Tefillin and Tzitzis and Zionism is one of the, and Bris Milah and Pidyon HaBen. So Zionism is one of the 613 mitzvahs. I give it equal time. Here, I spoke about Kahanim in medical school, modern Orthodox, Trailers, talk about everything. So one of the things I talk about is living in Eretz Yisrael. It's a mitzvah, like all the mitzvahs. Is it permissible to play basketball on Shabbos? We have the list of the 39 malachas that are prohibited. But in addition to the 39 malachas, which are aloises, an iser, there's a mitzvah of Shabbos on Shavuos to observe Shabbos with the Shabbos Dika atmosphere. So that's why the Aruch HaShulchan quotes a passage from the Talmud Yerushalmi that there was a city in Eretz Yisrael during the period of the Second Beis Hamikdash where the parents allowed the children to play ball on Shabbos and the whole city was destroyed at the time of the Churban Bayis Sheni, and Yerushalmi attributes it to the fact that they allowed the children to play ball on Shabbos. There's no malach involved. If you have an Erev, there's no malach involved. But it's a violation of the mitzvah of Shabbos and Shavuos. Shabbos is supposed to be dedicated to spiritual activities. Depends how old the children are. Little babies, they're not Baruch Yav Chinuch. But when a child is old enough to understand what Shabbos is all about, so we should instill with them the understanding that Shabbos is for spiritual growth. Play ball in the middle of the week. In some communities, they have an Erev, so they publish a pamphlet. They explain the Erev is not for the purpose. You see, they have an Erev, so some people will bring their filthy magazines to the park on Shabbos. Have an Erev, so they can read their magazines on Shabbos. The Erev is not for reading the magazines on Shabbos. The Erev is not for playing ball either. So the rabbis, usually those who distribute such a pamphlet, so they explain that's misusing the Erev. This is a serious question. What is the halachic status of a non-observant Jew? Non-observant Jew, the Talmud has the comment, Yisrael afal pishuchot Yisrael, he's Jewish. You want to sell your chametz to a goy, you can't sell your chametz to a non-observant Jew. You need a Shabbos goy. You can't use a non-observant Jew as a Shabbos goy. He's Jewish. So what's the issue? What's the shaila? Can you be mitzarefim to a minyan? So on Shulchan Aruch they quote a tshuva from the Rambam, that if a person is an apikores dina kenachri, and a non-Jew can't be mitzarif to a minyan, so an apikores can't be mitzarif to a minyan. So that's a question. Vos haste an apikores. Apikores means one who doesn't believe, the Rama says, apikores, one who doesn't believe in the 13 principles of faith. So that's a question. What if a person is an apikores b'shoigeg? He was never educated. He never heard anything. He doesn't know the Torah min Hashemayim. Never heard the Jew. He was brought up as a totally assimilated Jew. So that's a famous dispute. The Rambam writes that one is an apikores if he thinks that God has a body. That's an apikores. We believe that God doesn't have any body. So the Ravid writes, I think the Rambam is right, God does not have a body. But how can you consider one an apikores if he thinks God has a body? There were gdoilim v'toivim hemenu, there were bigger tzaddikim than the Rambam who mistakenly thought that God has a body because of the agodos, Hamashapshas Hasadas, because of the Midrashim that mislead the reader into believing that God has a body. So the Ravid seems to assume that one is an apikores b'shoigeg, does not have the status of an apikores. So that's the question, does the Rambam disagree? Or does the Rambam also agree? So that's the Chazon Ish is not sure about that. What's the status of one as an apikores b'shoigeg? Do we treat him as an apikores dina kenochri? Or not? The Rishonim discuss it a little bit. This halacha, apikores dina kenochri, is that a din d'oraisa or is that a penalty of the rabbanon? If it's on, there's a machlokes of Rishonim at the beginning of Chulin, the Chido, in his commentary on the on Yankif. The Chido wrote something like 80 svarim. The story goes that the Chido wrote as many svarim as the number of years that he lived. He lived up into his 80s, I think, 83 or something. So he wrote many, many Sfarim. People have a whole bookcase of all the Sfarim of the Chido. And each Sefer, not stump, each Sefer is a whole Sefer, a whole encyclopedia of this, encyclopedia of that, a whole bunch of encyclopedias. He lived in the 1700s when the Jews started writing encyclopedias. So the Chido, in his commentary on the An Yankif, in the beginning of Chulan and Daf Hey and Avov, quotes a dispute from Balei HaTesis, and manuscripts from the Kisvei Yad, whether apikores dina kakam is a din min haTorah or a penalty min the Rabbanon. The difference is, if it's a penalty min the Rabbanon, so you don't penalize a man if he's b'shoigeg. He was never given the opportunity to hear anything. His parents never gave him a Jewish education. But let's say a non-Jew is not Jewish. It's a penalty. He's not Jewish. He was born a non-Jew. We have nothing against him. He came to Mitzarev, a non-Jew, to the minyan. He's not Jewish. It's not his fault. So if you say, whoever doesn't believe in Ikori HaMuna has an incomplete Kedusha Sisra, so if you think that that's a din min haTorah, it's not a penalty mid the Rabbanim. So it should apply even if the person is an apikores b'shoigeg. So that's what the Chido quotes. That's a question. You're not permitted to ask him to turn on the lights for Yom Shabbos. You can't use him as the Shabbos guy. He's Jewish. All human beings have tzelem elokim. We assume poshib shat. Chaviv adam shaviv b'tzel. Chaviv yisal shenikru banim lamokim. So the simple reading of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says that all people have tzelem elokim. Others disagree. The Maran Liprak says no. Adam Arishon was created b'tzelem elokim. And the Kuzari writes that this inyan eloki, the tzelem elokim that he had, was only transmitted to one of his children. Adam sheis enesh kena mahalalo. Adam only transmitted the Inyan Halaki to Shais. Shais had many children, he only transmitted the Inyan Halaki to Enosh, and so on. Until it came to Avram. Avram had more than one son, only Yitzchak had the Inyan Halaki, the Tzelem Halakim. And then Yitzchak had twin sons, Yankov and Esav. He only transmitted the Inyan Halaki to Yaakov and not to Esav. And Yaakov was Mitos Shleima. Mitos Shleima means all of his children were Jewish. They all have the Inyan Halaki. So the Maral Miprag goes with this position of the Kuzari that the Tzelem Elokim is only for the Jews. The non-Jews no longer have any Tzelem Elokim. Chaviv Adam Arishim was never but Tzelem, and Inyan Elokim only went to one of his children, and now it was diverted, it only goes to the descendants of Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. But we usually don't assume like that. We usually assume that the non-Jews also were created the Tzelem Elokim, and the Jews have even a deeper degree of Tzelem Elokim that we call Barim Lamakan. You have to treat everyone with dignity. You have to treat the non-Jews with dignity while they're alive. You have to treat the Jews with dignity even after they die. There's a mitzvah of kvura and meisa Yisroel. And meisa Yaakov, there is no mitzvah of kvura. Because they're alive, you have to treat everybody with dignity. That's Tzelem Elokim. There's different opinions in the Medrash regarding the Aseres HaDibros. How do they appear on the Luchos? So there's one opinion, all Aseres HaDibros appeared on this Luach and on the two cubes, gigantic stones, the Shnei Luchos HaBris. So the one opinion, all Aseres HaDibros appeared 1 to 10 on this one, 1 to 10 on that. The more popular opinion is where it usually appears on the Parochas. You have 1 to 5 on one side and 6 to 10 on the other side. So the Meiri quotes a Medrash in his introduction to Shas, that according to that position, that is 1 to 5 and 6 to 10 on the other side. So 6 is parallel to 1, they're connected, and 7 is connected with 2, and 8 is connected with 3, and so on. And the Medrash explains what it means. Lo Sirtzach is connected with Anochi Hashem Elokecha, because God created everybody B'Tzelem Elokim. So if you kill somebody, you're demonstrating you don't believe in God, you don't believe in that man was created B'Tzelem Elokim. You're not allowed to kill anybody, you're not allowed to kill a Jew or a non-Jew. Everyone was created B'Tzelem Elokim. And Lysinov is parallel to Liyalachalim Acherim Alpana. The Jewish people is considered like married to God. That's the whole Shir Hashirim. The relationship between God and the Jewish people is one like a marriage. And just like the wife is not allowed to go have an affair with anybody else, so we're not allowed to go worship Abed Azar. That's like Lysinov and so on. The Medrash continues. So we, all of the basis of all the mitzvahs, Benodim HaChaveirom, is based on the fact that man was created B'Tzelem Elokim. So when a person is alive, even the non-Jews have to be treated with dignity. They have, so we assume they have Tzelem Elokim. And after the person dies, that's only by Jews. Even after they die, because they had an added feature of Banim Lamakim, so that even applies, that's a little, needs a little more explanation, that even applies even after the person dies. But the non-observant Jew, it also has the Banim Lamakim. Also you have to treat him with dignity. What happens when a family doesn't keep the same level of kashrus that I keep? You got a big problem.
I think the question was about your family.
I understand.
I mean, the parents.
I understand, yeah. You mean I'm going to come back to America and my parents don't keep the same level of kashrus that I keep? So in Shulchan Aruch, there are different levels of dinim. Gemara in Shulchan Aruch, a halacha is not always black and white. There are a lot of gray areas in halacha. Every so often there's a din that lachatchila something is osa and b'diyevet it's muta. Take just one example. There are 1,001 examples. One example, if you have a treifa pot that hasn't been used for treifas in the last 24 hours, so lachatchila you're not allowed to cook in the pot, that's an issa m'derabbanan, but b'diyevet if you cook kosher food in the pot, after 24 hours went by, that's called the klisha enim en yomo, so the kosher food will not become treif. So then, that's one rule. Then we have a rule that shas hatchak kidiyevid dami. If you have a difficult circumstance, so you're permitted to do lachatchila, but normally it's only permissible b'diyevid. So to give an example of this in Shulchan Aruch, the Jews never had their own bakery. They had to rent the right to use the non-Jewish baking tins and rent time in the non-Jewish bakery. The non-Jewish bakers used to bake bread with lard. Now in the East Coast in America, nobody bakes with lard. Maybe in the South, a New England area, a New York area, nobody bakes with lard. Most of the breads are kosher in the New York area, even the non-Jewish breads. Italian breads are all kosher. For sure they don't have any lard. So in the days of the Balei HaTosis, they had a problem. The Goyim would give them the right to use their baking tins, but they baked with lard. So the Jew wanted to kasher it, they wouldn't allow them to kasher. Either use the baking tin the way it is, or go fly kite. We don't need your business. So they would wait, but you need bread. So today, we're all used to living without bread. Who eats bread? On Shabbos, we're stuck, so we have to say, I'm so we eat bread all week long. Most people don't wash, they don't eat bread. But in Europe, if you know any Europeans, or Israelis are like that, they eat 6 slices of bread every meal. The main part of the meal is the bread. In Europe, the main part was the bread. By us, we eat another steak, and another steak, and then I have 20 courses in the meal. So the Rishonim have an expression, Al halechem yichyeh ha'adam. Chumash, it says, Lo al halechem labado yichyeh ha'adam. Not on bread alone does man live, but Al halechem yichyeh ha'adam. You need bread to live. So that was considered a Shas Hadchak. So in Shulchan Aruch, they quote the Taisus, who says that if you have no choice, and the Goyim will only allow you to bake on the baking tin without kashering it, so if you wait 24 hours since the last time that they baked on the baking tin, even though they baked with lard, it's a cliche in a ben yomo, so shas hadchak kedi yevedom. Since you have no alternative and you have to have bread in order to live, so you're permitted to bake the bread on the tray for cliche in a ben yom. So let's say today sometimes you have such a shaila. There's a factory where they process ice cream. So they make milchig ice cream, make parva ice cream. And you can't kasher in between the milching and the parva, it's after 24 hours. So shas hadchak, you can't exist without parva ice cream. So we should be able to process the parva ice cream on the same machinery as the milchig ice cream if it's a cliche. If that's a joke, we can live without the parva, we can live without the milchig ice cream, we can live without ice cream. The kula only applies al alechem yechiyodim if it's something that's very important. So if a boy's going back home, and he knows that the pots are treif, and he can't kasher them. So sometimes when your parents go away to a wedding or something, so you kasher the pots, so you table them in a mikveh, let's say. Person knows that his parents would never table the kelim. So do a little at a time. Don't take all the kelim one time. Keep track. Write a record. Try to go to the mikveh, take a couple of kelim at a time to the table the kelim. It's a mitzvah to do tefillas kelim. If you can't do the tefillas kelim, if you can't kasher the kelim, so you don't have to leave your home. You don't have to fight with your parents. You don't have to kill your parents. I belong to the parents' union. Don't kill the parents. Try to maintain peace with the parents. So if you have no choice, so you eat, if they're cooking kosher food in a tray for cliche, in a menyoma, so b'diyebed it's kosher, so b'shas atrake diyebed don. Sometimes it's a little more serious an issue than that. Let's say they buy meat that doesn't really have a good hashgach. So that you can't eat. Okay. I remember I met a boy once years ago in the NCSY summer program. So the boy told me his parents don't keep kosher. They eat mamish nevela. They don't have kosher meat at all. And he knows that in Shulchan Aruch the din is that you don't say a bracha when you eat non-kosher meat. So he feels uncomfortable to eat the meat without saying a bracha. So he always washes for bread because the bread is always kosher. He always washes for bread. He says, I'm like, he doesn't have to say a bracha when he eats the non-kosher meat. Under the circumstances, the boy had no choice. What's he going to do? He's a high school boy. What's he going to do? He's going to run away from home. Has no brera. So he had to eat the non-kosher meat. And he was chalashing to say a bracha. So he washed for bread every day. So he wouldn't be in violation, to the best of his life. He wouldn't be in violation of eating the non-kosher meat without reciting a bracha. You do the best you can. Look, you have to consult with your local Orthodox rabbi to try to figure out how to substitute different ingredients and how to get the higher level of kashrus. When you live with a family with a not observant, so it's clearly a shas hadchak. So b'shas hadchak, we are makel whatever is mutter b'riyevid. So b'shas hadchak is mutter lahatchil. But you have to know, not everything is mutter b'riyevid. Some things are even aser b'riyevid. The other day we were discussing a shaila. The din is that the chazan, the shliach tzibur, has to be a religious man. If the official chazan in the shul is not religious, so it's not proper to have him serve as a chazan. He's the shliach tzibur, he's representing us. God will may not want to listen to his prayers if he himself is not so religious. So there was a shaila in the late 1500s, early 1600s. There was a chazan who didn't keep kosher. They discovered the chazan didn't keep kosher. So in the Talmud, there's a Tana by the name of Shimon Hamsoni, who had an attitude. He went with a position that every time the word es appears in the Chumash, Bereishis Bara Elokim, es haShamayim ve'es haAretz, it must be marbe something. So the Gemara says, Shimon Hamsoni hayadorish kol es ve'yes shabbat. Every time it says the word es, it means to be marbe something. It means to add on something. In Yiddish, the word es, ayin samach, means to eat something. So the rabbi of the village sent a shaila to another prominent Talmud Chacham, Shimon, the Chazan's name was Shimon. Shimon said, Dorish kol es v'yesh shabbat. Es ha-chazir, es ha-gomel, es ha-nem. So he ate all the non-kosher foods. He ate non-kosher foods. But he had a beautiful voice, and the Balabatim enjoyed the way he davened. So the rabbi wanted to fire the Chazan. He's not observant. He spoke to him, and he's not going to change. He's not observant. The rabbi wanted to fire the chazan, but he's going to fire the chazan. He's going to make a big machlokes in the community because the Baal HaBatim enjoyed. They didn't care about the fact that it didn't keep kosher. They enjoyed his beautiful voice. So the shaila was, what should he do? Should he fire the chazan and cause a machlokes, or should he let the chazan continue to dab? So the tshuva was given. It's printed in one of the volumes from the 1600s. Mutav lahamid tzelem behechel. It's better to leave a crucifix in the shul rather than make a machlekes. I don't know if the rabbi really meant to leave a crucifix in the shul. He meant to allow the chazan to continue to daven even though he's a bal avera is more important than to make machlekes. What does he mean? It means a shas hatchaki the yevidomi. Bid the yevid if he'll daven for an omer, bid the yevid, everybody will be yotze. Lachatchila, it's not proper to have him daven. So in order not to make a major machlekes in the shul, that's shas hatchak. So b'shas atchak we allow lachatchila, what usually is only permissible b'diavad. So you have to figure out how bad is the situation of the kashrus. Is it really even also b'diavad? Then you have to fast taneisim. Then you have to don't eat all the food in the house. And if something is also lachatchila muta b'diavad, so then if it's a big shas atchak, so you can. There's room to be made. You have to discuss with the local author, that's rabbi, the details of the situation. How do you act in the mixed environment of Ashkenazim and Sephardim? Can one adopt halachas and norms of the other? What about attending davening? Or do the two have to remain separate? Or can we start thinking of methods of integration when the yeshiva does not have enough Sephardim to support his Sephardim minyan? If you don't have enough Sephardim, so of course the Sephardim have to daven by Ashkenazi minyan. If they daven by Ashkenazi minyan, so whatever they daven softly, they can continue davening in their nusach svar. Whatever is going to become obvious, let's say, on Monday or Thursday, when you say tachnun, so the tzvardim say vidui, and then they say tachnun before v'huracham, and Ashkenazim don't say vidui, and Ashkenazim say v'huracham before tachnun. So whatever is going to be obvious that they're not observing the minhag hamakom, that's not proper. Whether Ashkenazi visiting by Sephardim or Sephardi visiting by Ashkenazim, you have to do things in public the way that you're not allowed to be mishanim in minhag hamakom if it's going to be an obvious shina. Rabbi Gorin tried to introduce in the army a nusach achid. He tried to blend them together. I don't know, did it work? Didn't work. Nobody wants to give in. Everybody wants to follow their traditions. It's quoted in the name of the Arizal that La'asid Lava, it says in the end of the Novi Yecheskel, La'asid Lava, Yerushalayim is going to have a wall around it for protection, and there'll be 13 sha'arim, 13 gates to enter Yerushalayim, and each gate will be Shar Reuven, Shar Shimon, Shar Ephraim, Shar Manasseh. Each gate will be whoever knows what shevet he belongs to enters Yerushalayim through that gate, and then the 13th gate is known as the Shar HaKoilel, the miscellaneous gate. The Gerim, whoever does know what Sheva he belongs to, should enter through that gate. So what is this all about? So the Arizal says, entering Yerushalayim means to come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're going to the Beis HaMikdash to come closer to God. And each Sheva HaKadosh Baruch Hu appreciates variety. The Zohar has a comment on the Pasuk. When Yitzchak requested of his son Esau that he should go hunting and prepare delicious food for him, and he wants to give him a blessing before he dies, he said, "Vaseli matamim, make delicious foods for me, and I'll give you a blessing before I die. So why does he ask us Seli Matamin? He's hungry. So have another piece of steak. He's still hungry. Have a third piece of steak. What do you need? The soup and the fish and the salad and the dessert and the kugel and the cholent. So many different courses. If you're still hungry, eat another piece. The answer is, people enjoy variety. So you have many courses on the table. You nibble a little bit of this and a little bit of a lot of this and a lot of that. Well, you eat different things. So the Zohar has a comment that just like human beings appreciate variety, we say, Aseli Matamim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu also appreciates variety. HaKadosh Baruch Hu finds it boring. The Rav Chaim Yisrael keeps all the mitzvahs exactly the same thing. Like the gingerbread man. Make exactly all the cookies in the same cookie mold. Everybody's the exact same. Baruch Shalom appreciates variety. So that's why he wanted to institute Yudvei Shvatim. And every Shevet is supposed to have its own Sanhedrin. The Mishnah says in Harius, there was a Sanhedrin, a Chol Shevet v'Shevet. There's a Bez Nagoral in Yerushalayim. Whatever they say is binding on all of Klal Yisrael. And then there was a Sanhedrin for each Shevet individually. The Rabban HaChumash is not sure. We have no sources whether the Rosh, the Sanhedrin, Shol Kol Shevet had 23 members or 71 members. He's not sure. But the Mishnah says the Sanhedrin, every Shevet had its own Sanhedrin. Because every Shevet was supposed to do Avodas Hashem with a different twist. The Rebbe Shlomo appreciates the variety. So the Arizal says that there are 13 Nuschos HaTfilah. Whoever knows what Shevet he belongs to should daven with that Nuschos HaTfilah. That's more matim and more fits in. It fits in better with his Shoresh Neshama. And whoever doesn't know what Shevet he belongs to, there's a Shar HaKoilo. There's a nusach that's good for everybody. Then the Arizal has the punchline of the whole body. He says, Nusach Ari is the Shara Koilum. So that's, not everybody agrees to that. That's what the Arizal thought. The Nusach Ari is the Shara Koilum. That's why there's a sefer called Shara Koilum that explains the Nusach Ari. It's written by the author of the Kavanoki. There's a sefer called Kavanoki that everybody in the world, when they're Masada Gibna, they all use the Kavanoki. That's the standard sefer. So the author of the Kavanoch happened to have been a Lubavitcher Chassid, and he wrote the Sefer Shara Koilum, a thin little Sefer to explain the Nusach Ari. So in the introduction to the Sefer, he explains why he called it the Shara Koilum. It's based on this. The Morgan Avraham quotes this from the Arizal, with the 13 Nuschos Hafil. So the Sephardim have their own Nusach, and the Ashkenazim have their own Nusach, and each has his own. It's healthy to have variety, but it shouldn't be with machlokes. The Rabban Shalom wanted Melech HaTchila 12 different shvatim. He wanted to have 13 shorim in Yerushalayim. Everyone should approach the Rabban Shalom from a different perspective, from a different angle. But they should all keep all of their mitzvahs. That there's nothing wrong with. But if you have in one shul, different people said that. The Gemara says in the end of the first paragraph of the Rambam, that's an issue of lois is goydudu. The pash pshat in the pasuk lois is goydudu means that someone dies, and you're so upset, so you're going to take a fork and a knife and scratch into your skin until you're going to start bleeding. So that's prohibited. The non-Jews used to have such a practice to demonstrate their grief over the death of a close relative. They would scratch the body until it would bleed. And we believe in the neshama continues to live on after the person dies, and God tells us we shouldn't scratch our bodies. Lois is gadadu. The Gemara says, also included in Pasuk, Lois is gadadu, you're not allowed to make agudas agudas. You know that a split, Klal Yisrael, that it shouldn't look as if we have two different religions. So we shouldn't have in the same community. If you have two different shuls, one shul daven nusach Ashkenaz, one shul daven nusach Svar. Mara said that's okay. But if you have in the same shul, half of the people are going to be wearing tefillin and chalamoid, half of the people not going to be wearing tefillin and chalamoid. So it looks as if you're observing two different religions. Half of the people are going to daven like this, half of the people are going to daven like that. So you should try to have everybody integrate. We want to have separate. The Rabban Shalom appreciates variety, but it shouldn't look like it's a shtei teres. In Eretz Yisrael, there's always tumult. So I was just told about this. Rabbi Liv Anon recently came out with a statement that it's Yehorek Bal Yavah to listen to the Kolish at army events, and therefore a soldier should walk out, even if his commander tells him not to. I don't know. To me, it is a little exaggerated. The Balei HaTosfos.
The Rabbanim said it to me, Yehorek Bal Yavah.
Yes.
He should face what he called a kitat yorim, the firing squad.
Right.
The woman sing. under orders in Yom.
Yeah, there's a 5-volume biography of the Chazon Ish that's called Pe'er Hador. Years ago, people had more time on their hands. They used to read 5 volumes. Now nobody has gedul to read, so they have 1-volume biography. So I'm from the older generation, so I read the 5 volumes. So they have there that on one occasion, there was a student learning in Ponovich Yeshiva from London, and his mother passed away, his father remarried. And there was a modern Orthodox, Yekesh Shul. See, after davening on Shabbos, it was understood that you have to shake hands with the women, you have to shake hands with your stepmother. So the boy became Fafrumt in the yeshiva, and he asked the Chazon Ish, what should he do? They want him to shake hands with his mother. He said, you heard by Yavar, not allowed to shake hands. So in the footnote, on the bottom of the page, I have a long footnote, that the stipler said, sometimes we use an expression, you heard by Yavar, as an exaggeration. You just mean to say that you shouldn't do it, but it doesn't mean you have to stand in front of the fire inspector. That's in the Pe'er Hador. Pe'er Hador, the whole book is Fafrumt. So they write that sometimes we use the expression as an exaggeration. The Balei HaTosfos are quoted. The Hagos Mamina on the bottom of the Rama quotes the Balei HaTosfos that they had a problem in their communities. There would be non-Jewish women who would be singing songs in the street. They would be davening inside the house or learning Tosfos, learning Gemara with Tosfos, composing Tosfos. And the women were singing in the street. So they said that we turned off our hearing aid and we didn't pay attention to it, and that's all. You have it. Kalisha is if you're paying attention. See, here they're singing, it's different. Here the girls are singing in the street, here they're singing for the boys in the army. But still, you turn off your hearing and you mind your own business, and you don't pay attention, you don't listen. I don't think I would have walked out. I don't know. How good looking is the girl who sings? How alluring is she? How well dressed is she? If it's really such a princess, maybe it is Yohar Gvaya. The other girl, what is she singing? Hatikva? What is she singing? Love songs. Not singing love songs. Singing probably Shire Ha'am, Shire HaMedina. I don't think. I think he meant like the footnote of that sometimes we use the expression Yehoi Al Gaber as an exaggeration. So he does not mean that as an exaggeration.
In YU, you remember the time that they brought that female singer and that was the whole thing? The Rav said, the question came to the Rav, and then they, you don't remember that. The student council hired a female singer to come. And in those days in YU, not everybody was aware of the problem of Kalisha, but somebody brought it to the Rav, and the Rav said they shouldn't do it, and there was a whole fight, but the Rav never said everybody
should go in front of a firing squad. The Chavetz Chaim asked that question. There's a Gemara that says that if you go to wash, they didn't have washing machines. They used to take the clothing, dirty clothing, to the river to wash. So when the women went to wash the clothing by the river, they would roll up their dresses, so the bottom of their legs would be exposed. So the Gemara says if a person has to pass by the women who are washing their clothing, it's terrible, they're not allowed to pass by because they rolled up their dresses. So the Chafetz Chaim in Hilchos Lashon Hara has this discussion. A group is sitting talking Lashon Hara, so walk away, don't be there. But if it's your boss and it's in the middle of the business, I can't walk away, I'm stuck there. So he says you should try to turn off your hearing aid and don't pay attention and don't participate in the conversation and shine. And lo yapshav lo kamachaben. So don't listen to Shani. So then in the footnote on the bottom of the page, yes, if that's correct, so why does the Gemara scream at the guy who walks by the women? He's walking home, he has to wash his own clothes. What's so terrible? Lo yapshav lo kamachaben. What's so terrible? He's not paying attention to the women, so it should be mutter. So he says the rabbis of the Talmud knew that healthy men have a yetzahara for good looking women. Young, old, I'm over 70 years old, I have a Yetzirah for a good-looking woman. And young people, healthy people, should certainly have a Yetzirah. Otherwise, you're not healthy. You should certainly have a Yetzirah. It's not a Yetzirah. You should have a Yetzirah for a good-looking woman. So the rabbis knew that it's not going to be Yefshir. It is going to be Kamechav. That's what the Chafetz Chaim writes. He thinks that it will be Kamechav. Yeah, but yeah, you have to ignore it. You have to ignore it. What do you do with menhagim I'm not sure what this question means. Number seven, what do you do with menhagim that no longer make any sense? So, the Gemara has a klal with respect to a takana derabana. If the rabbis institute a takana derabana for a specific reason, and you live in a generation where the whole reason doesn't apply, or you live in a country, you live under certain circumstances where the whole reason doesn't apply. So most of the takanas derabanan, 99% of the takanas derabanan, were instituted as a loyplug. Under all circumstances, even if you live in an area, even if you live in a generation where the reason doesn't apply, the takana derabana still applies, unless the rabbis repeal the takana derabana. Dovish minyan, zach minyan achal atiro. So the pasuk say halacha lemaisa, that only applies to a takana derabana. If you have a minyan that was instituted for a certain reason, when you live in a country or you live in a generation where the whole reason simply doesn't apply, the minyan just disappears by itself. You don't have to continue observing the minig. Rav Chaim Moser has the last tshuva in the third volume of Achiezer, the last tshuva in Achiezer that he printed during his lifetime. This is what he writes, and others say the same as well. The Ramo has such a tshuva also, based on a Rashi in the first Perek and Beis, by Menhagim, that rule does not apply. I remember I live in Washington Heights, so Rabbi Schwab was the rabbi in the Breuer's community, so he... He mentioned on one occasion that some communities in Hungary, in Germany, have a minhag not to eat chicken on Pesach. Why? Because in Europe they used to feed kernels of grain to the chickens. So the kernels of grain got digested in the belly. So sometimes they would shech the chicken before the kernels of grain had a chance to get digested. And then they would cook the whole chicken together with the whole belly with everything. And then when they would find in the pot of the chicken cooking, there the final kernel of grain that was just cooked. So there was a concern, maybe turn into chametz. Maybe turn into chametz. If you cook kernels of grain, it can turn into chametz. So they had this minig in certain parts of Germany and Hungary, not to eat chicken on Pesach, only to eat flesh. So Rabbi Schwab said, whoever has that minig no longer applies bizman hazeh, because none of the farmers feed kernels of grain to the chicken. Everybody gives them maize, corn on the cob. It's much less expensive. You have to be crazy to spend so much money to feed the chickens grain. And by Minhagim, the principle of Davar Shebeminyan doesn't apply. I'm not sure what the question means. Sometimes you have a din in the Gemara that's based on a mistake. Based on a mistake of information. Now, the din that's based on a mistake is not binding. There's one din from all the 613 mitzvahs. There's one area of halacha where the rabbis make a mistake and the din is binding. Is only one case, Kiddush HaChodesh. That's all. When the peasant declares that today should be Rosh Chodesh, so it depends. They can make any given month 29 or 30 days. They can make any given year 12 or 13 months. They can't have a year of 11 months. They can't have a year of 14 months. They can't have a month of less than 29 days and more than 30 days. But within this range, 29, 30 days, even if they make a mistake, it absolutely doesn't correspond to when the moon appears. So even though they were fooled and they made a mistake, that's a pasuk. Katam afilu mutamidim if they made a mistake. But in all the other 612 mitzvahs, a psakin error is absolutely not binding. So that's a big pilpul now. The Talmud sounds like it says, the rabbis are still fighting about this, Talmud sounds like it says, that the worms and the fish may be eaten because the worms originated as fish and the fish developed into a worm. That's what it sounds like in the Gemara. The fish developed into a worm. So the scientists today say that there is no such thing. Fish doesn't develop into worms. There were eggs from the worms that developed into worms. The fish never develops into worms. So some rabbis say, so all the worms and all the fish are usher. The only worms that are kosher are those holy worms that the rabbis of the Talmud knew that were spontaneously generated. You have a piece of fish and the fish turns into a worm. So those worms are mutter. And the scientists say it doesn't exist. So they're apikursin. Such a worm does exist. But we believe half of what the scientists say, that all the worms that we're eating did not came from eggs of worms. So all the worms are us. So this is a joke. We know the scientists are not telling us a lie. We know it's true. Louis Pasteur proved that no such thing as spontaneous generation. It's interesting. The Rambam writes in one place, Rambam interprets a certain din based on spontaneous generation. And then he says, and anybody who doesn't believe in spontaneous generation doesn't know the ABC of science. Anybody knows anything about science knows there is such a thing as spontaneous generation, that garbage can develop into worms. That's what the Rambam writes. So many of the rabbis were very upset when Louis Pasteur proved no such thing as Patenish generation. So how can it be? The Rambam made a mistake. The Gemara made a mistake. The Rambam made a mistake. So the communists didn't believe in God. So if you don't believe in spontaneous generation, so where did original life come from? It didn't happen by itself. So you have to believe in God, that God created the original worm, God created the original fish, God created the original person. If no spontaneous generation, so God, you have to believe in God. The scientists didn't believe in God. So they paid the scientists to disprove Louis Pasteur. From money you can do anything. So they disproved Pasteur. So many rabbis were dancing from joy when the communist scientists proved that there can be spontaneous generation. Many rabbis were rejoicing. Ah, we finally saved the Rambam, we finally saved the Tanoi. And others said, Anoch and Vey, that the Apikursim who don't believe in God, so they have to prove that there is spontaneous generation. So they're saving the Rambam. We do believe in God. We believe God created life. We don't believe in spontaneous generation. This is ridiculous. The scientists were lying. Of course Pasteur is right. It's Makubal all over the world. There's no such thing as spontaneous generation. So what do you do with this din in the Gemara? So those Rabbanim who say, they say, the Gemara made a mistake, so the din is wrong. So you're not allowed to eat any of those worms. Anybody who eats herring, herring always has the worms. All herring in the world has these holy worms that the Gemara says are kosher. So in the different badatsim all over the world came out, but the cold kairis gave a whole list of 25 fish that you're not allowed because they're all infested with worms. But herring, everybody, the herring, that's the exception to the rule. Why is it an exception to the rule? It's the same holy worms as the other. Either they're all kosher or they're all treif. So the answer is they're all kosher. The Gemara says they're kosher. Aye, but the Gemara says it's based on a mistaken understanding. So that's the question, how do you deal with the Gemara? So some interpret the Gemara differently. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, obviously there's no spontaneous generation. What it means is that it's not visible to the naked eye. It conveys the appearance as if it, because they're microscopic. The eggs are microscopic before they develop. And when they develop into worms, we don't see it. It looks as if the fish is developing into worms. And since they're microscopic, so that's considered as if the fish turned into worms. That's how Rav Shlomo Zalman interpreted the Gemara. Others interpret differently that the worms that can, the fish swallows the worms through the mouth and goes into the stomach. So the Gemara says the worms that can succeed in penetrating through the membrane of the stomach and getting into the flesh of the fish, even before they penetrate in, becomes part of the fish. They would treif before the fish swallowed it. Once the fish swallows it, so then it depends on different kinds of worms, the Gemara says. So those that cannot penetrate through the membrane to go into the flesh, those worms are treif and they don't become kosher. Those that can penetrate through, so even before they penetrate through, the Beis Yosef says that the worms in the stomach of the fish are osa misofek. Maybe they will be able to penetrate through, maybe they won't be able to penetrate. Now they're not going to penetrate, everything is dead. But those worms that could have penetrated through, so the minute the fish swallows them, they blend to become part of the fish. That's how others say, based on the Beis Yosef. That's an issue. How do you deal with the din in the Gemara that's based on a mistake, in fact? There was a prominent Talmud Chacham who wrote a knockout Sefer on Chulin. He wrote a Sefer that's called Dor Revi. He was the fourth generation of the Chassam Sefer. His name was Moshe. I think he writes he was the first great-grandson who was named after the Chassam Sofer. His name is Moshe, after the Chassam Sofer. He was a Zionist, huh?
Glasner,
yeah. So he was a Zionist. So the Satmar Rebbe held his, he was an Apikoros, and the whole Sofer is no good. Sofer is a knockout Sofer. Modern thinker. Modern, like Brisk. You look in the Sofer, very open. He shows, I don't know who he was. You're a relative or what?
No,
very gewaltige Sefer. So he has an introduction to his Sefer Chulin. It's like an introduction to all of Torah Shebal Peh. So he has a lot of controversial things there. What the dingzach with. So he deals with this issue also. What do you do if the rabbis made a mistake? So there's a contradiction between different sources in the Talmud, which the Ramban was the first one to point out in the commentary to the Sefer HaMitzvah. Ramban says, on the one hand, Rashi in his commentary on Chumash quotes from the Tanaim that you have to follow the Bez Nagor al Yamin Shehu Smol Bal Smol Sheyamin. Means, sounds like it means authority is binding even when it's an error. And this is in clear-cut contradiction to the opening Mishnah in Horeas, that if the Bez Nagor al gives a unanimous psak, and I know that they're wrong, you're not allowed to follow the Bez Nagor. Authority is not binding when it's an error. So how do you deal with this contradiction? So the Ramban has one suggestion, and others give other suggestions. So this, in the introduction to this Sefer, Doravi, he gives the following suggestion, which I think is, it doesn't speak to me. So he says, it depends. When the rabbis gave the psak, was it already known in their generation that it was wrong, but they were ignorant? So then a psak and error is not good. But if in their generation, they all believed in spontaneous generation, it took till the 1700s till Louis Pasteur disproved it. So since that, in their generation, that was considered scientifically accurate, like the Rambam says, anybody doesn't mean spontaneous, doesn't know the ABC of science. So if in their generation it was correct, even though later on we discover that it was incorrect, so then the psak is binding. But to me, it doesn't make sense. Why? Wrong is wrong. What's the difference when in their generation it was not, wasn't? So he saves, he thinks he saved the Gemara. The Gemara talks about the worms and the fish. He can eat the worms because they're generated for this. He's allowed to kill these bugs on Shabbos because it's spontaneous generation. So he said, since in their generation, that's what they thought, so the din is good. So that's his approach. Okay, take it or leave it. It doesn't talk to me. I didn't like his suggestion. The Pashto says, whenever you have a din that's based on an error, if it's absolutely an error, then you don't follow it. Rabbi Soloveitchik once said in public at a Chag HaSmicha, every couple of years in the yeshiva, they would celebrate Chag HaSmicha. Every 2-3 years, they had enough of a smocha, so they would invite the parents to celebrate. So the main speaker, Dr. Belkin, would speak for 15 minutes. He was not a good public speaker. He didn't speak English well. Rabbi Soloveitchik would get up and give a whole address for an hour and give a charge to the Rabbanim, how they should function. And the Rabbi used to give always a major address. All of his talks were a major address. So on one occasion at the Chag HaSmicha, he was charging the rabbis, he was instructing them that they shouldn't rush to change the psak halacha when the scientists come up with a new chiddush. Because the scientists may change their minds in another couple of years, and the halacha is going to last on for a long time. Don't rush to change the halacha. Wait, if it'll turn out that for many years this is the accepted position, then we'll have to figure out what to do with the halacha. We shouldn't rush to change. Yeah, but this spontaneous generation, this has been around for a long time. We do follow Louis Pasteur. When it first came out in the 1700s, there was an encyclopedia that was written in Italy by Rabbi Yitzchak Lamprenti, the Pachad Yitzchak. So he raises this issue. What do we do with the Dinim and the Gemara that are based on spontaneous generation if Pasteur proved that there's no such thing? So he writes what the opinions of the Rabbanim, what his Rabbeim in Italy said about this. He was a prominent rabbi, Lamprenti, in Italy. So that's a famous issue. Rabbi Mendel Kasher, I always said Rabbi Mendel Kasher was a modern thinker with manuscripts in Kisvei Yad and so on, the Torah Shleim, he did so much work. So he has an essay in one of his Svarim, has a long section in the Sefer about Hilcha Shabbos. It goes to all the Lamates of his Melachos. He has beautiful comments on it. So he deals with this. How do you deal with this about killing these bugs that are spontaneously generated? So he works through all the different parts. So he comes to the conclusion that Louis Pasteur is wrong. I don't know. I lost a lot of my respect for Rabbi Kasher. I thought he was a modern thinker, reasonable. So I thought that's very unreasonable. It's been accepted since the 1700s that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation.
He says a similar approach with regard to evolution. Evolution's been around for a long time, too.
Evolution is a suggestion. It has never been proven. So some of the Svarim write how one can read into my separations.
A lot of the antibiotics that we use is based on assumptions of evolution. So we should use first generation penicillin only?
No,
because
it could be.
After all, evolution is only a theory.
If it works, it works. If the antibiotics work, they work. Maybe it's a different husband. Maybe it's not based on evolution. And the Pharisee Sorel on Mishnayos has a whole lesson. He thinks that maybe evolution can fit into the Chumash. The Chumash, the Talmud has a tradition, the Midrashim and the Talmud and Chagiga in the second parak have a tradition. Anything that's written before Yom HaShishi, V'chul HaShemayim, we're not supposed to delve into that. after Yom HaShish V'chol HaShemayim, after Adam HaRishma is created, then it's Kvod Malachim Chakor Dover. There's a pasuk in Mishlei. Kvod Elokim Hester Dover. Kvod Malachim Chakor Dover. It's the Kovod of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to keep things secret. And it's the Kovod of the Malachim to delve into everything. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu became a Melech after Adam HaRishma was created. He's not called the Melech if they're no human beings. So the Sheshes made Bereshes before Adam HaRishma was created. So the Medrash says we're not allowed to delve into that. That's Malafonim. That's Kvod Elokim Hester Dover. And after Adam HaRishma was created, after Yom HaShish V'chol HaShemayim, that's Kvod Malachim Chakor Dover. We should try to figure out all the secrets of science, try to figure out all the secrets of the halachas of the Torah. But we're told explicitly we should not try to delve into the Big Bang theory, or to try to figure out about evolution, what happened in the Sheshes Mei Bereshit. Whatever it says in Chumash is irrelevant for us. We're not supposed to delve into it, so we'll never know what's going on. The Talmud has a prohibition of Hotzoas Zera Levatola. A question in the Rishonim, whether it only applies to men or to women as well. Many Rishonim hold that it applies to women also. If a woman masturbates, even though there's no Zera, the Talmud talks about Ishmazriya Tchila, Ishmazras Tchila. So many Rishonim think that it applies to women as well. It certainly applies to men. It's a question whether this is a biblical prohibition or a rabbinical prohibition. Many are of the opinion that it's only rabbinical in nature. Some claim that that's the majority of the Pasuk think it's rabbinical. Doesn't matter, rabbinical, biblical. It is a prohibition. It's assumed that it's not Yehoreg Yaver. Commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch say, even though one who masturbates, one is Moitzei Zelavatola, is like Gilei Arayis. Gilei Arayis is Yehoreg Yaver, and this is not Yehoreg Yaver. The question is, why should there be such a prohibition? If the Zera will remain in the body, it's going to die, and it won't be able to develop to fertilize an egg. So it's not potent anyway. So why should there be an Isur HaTzoras? An interesting question, but the din is still a din. It's a good question. But you don't change the din because of the question. Yeah. The Rebbe Shalom created the whole world, and he doesn't want us to ruin his world. He doesn't want us to destroy the world. It's not proper. If flowers are growing, you're not allowed to rip off the flowers. That's also an Isur. The Bal Tashchis is mutter l'tzorach b'nei Adam. If you wanna use it as fuel in a fire, okay. But stam to break off branches from a tree for no good purpose, if the Erev is sagging because the branches are in the way, you have no choice. You have to break off the branches to have the string go straight. But to stam break off branches or to rip off flowers unnecessarily, so that's not permissible. The Baruch Shalom created a beautiful world, and he doesn't want us to ruin his world. So this is part of Hatzor Zalabatola. It's part of that general prohibition, not to ruin God's beautiful world. I don't know what Neil Hasidus is. What is Neil Hasidus? I'm not sure what Hasidus is. What is Neil Hasidus? Someone asked the question. What is my opinion about Neil Hasidus?
I didn't ask the question, but you know, in the world of yeshivas, you have, you know, like people are, people are in the Sanatovia if they're dancing, like, as if the Bible, but I'll shantel this, but who asked the question? Maybe they want you to help them. Not sure, I'm not sure what it refers to. Okay, maybe they want you to help them. Don't know. Good.
We're open the floor for whatever. Yeah.
There's another question that didn't end up on the sheet. Perhaps you can share with us a little bit about what it was like to be in the Rav Shir, what made it so special. I hear the Rav a lot. A lot of people are quoting it, but I don't know if you really, I wasn't in the
chat. I learned in the Rav Shir for 10 years when he was healthy, before he got sick. At the end of his life, he looked terrible. But all the pictures that they have hanging all over from the ladies turned my stomach. He looks awful. He used to be tall and handsome, so stately. He dressed so beautifully, clean, and he spoke so clearly. He used to speak Yiddish, beautiful Yiddish. He used to give yeshiva every Tuesday night for Balabatim, So I used to attend quite a few years. So all of the people were B'nai Torah. People would come from out of town. Businessmen would come from Europe or from out of town. They made sure they'd be in New York for Tuesday night. If they had to be in New York, made sure they got to be in New York for Tuesday night to attend the Shia. It wasn't such a big crowd, but they were learned people. So I remember there used to be one fellow came with a knitted yarmulke, only one man, with a bushy head of hair. I always wondered, who was this guy? And some of the people I knew, most of the people I didn't know. So Abba Brunschpiegel used to sit next to that fellow all the time. I always used to come a little, I used to sit in the women's section. There used to be two women over there, and then 50 men sitting in the women's section back at the shul. So Abba Brunschpiegel used to sit next to him. So he said, on one occasion, the rabbi always used to come 10 minutes late. She was supposed to begin at 8 o'clock. He used to come 5 after 8, 10 after 8. So on one occasion, people were talking till the rabbi came. So this fellow turns to Brunschpiegel and he says, in Yiddish, you're probably wondering what I'm doing here. I don't fit in. He comes to hear the klang of the Yiddish. He's not interested in the Shir and the Gemara. He was a Yiddishist. He enjoyed the Yiddish. In the early years, the Rav has such a beautiful Yiddish. Beautiful style of Yiddish. He used to be tall and handsome and clean dressed and so, and he would speak with such derecherets. Sometimes people speak very grub, very coarse. He would always speak in a very refined fashion, very elegant fashion. When he would take a position, he wouldn't exaggerate. His position would always be very nuanced. Life is not black and white. The Torah is not at all black and white. The Torah halacha is very nuanced because the world is very nuanced. They were always, his positions would all be very, very nuanced. I found just about 5 years ago, 8 years ago, something. I found there's in the library, in Yeshiva Gadisman Library, said they have old newspapers and old journals. So Bimikre, I came across an article. A correspondent for some Israeli newspaper, I don't remember his name, didn't register at all. He writes that he was in Rav Soloveitchik's home, and someone called on the telephone a shaila about an autopsy on a person who just died. So he said, it's not like an Eretz Yisrael that the Rabbanim are so black and white, everything. So Rabbi Soloveitchik was so nuanced, if it's like this, if it's like that. He had to call a doctor on the telephone and ask him 100 questions, and then he told the family they shouldn't permit the doctor to do an autopsy. But he would have been prepared to allow it under certain circumstances. And he says, the newspapers did an avla to Rabbi Soloveitchik, the way they quoted his position. You can't quote his position in one line. His position is always very nuanced. It was always nuanced on all issues. It wouldn't be black and white. Everything was very, he was very careful the way he spoke. His shiurim was so cheerful. His shiurim was so easy. He took the most complicated Gemara. It made everything easy. And after he finished delivering the shiur, you would kick yourself. Why didn't I realize? Of course, that's the pashup shot. Not that he came up with a genius teretz. He didn't come up with a genius teretz. He said, you learned pshat wrong. You read the words wrong. It means like that. I remember sometimes Rav Soloveitchik would quote a pasuk. I knew Chumash a little bit when I came to the class. He would quote a pasuk, and I would say, just the way he would pause in the pasuk, I thought, that's what the pasuk means. He wouldn't say anything, he just said the pasuk. I never realized that that's the pashup shat in the pasuk. He would always show, where does it say this in the Chumash? Where does it say it in the Mishnah? He would show all the things, where everything comes from. The shiur would always start from Chumash. It says in the Torah, and then the Mishnah says this. We'd always ask definitions. I remember we started learning Gittin. So he said, who can give me a good definition of a shtar? What do you mean a shtar? A definition of a shtar? Yeah, you have to give. When you go to college, you have to define all the terms before you begin the course. So he didn't know what he was talking about. What? And he showed us a machloikis, the shach and choshe mishpat, has a machloikis, hagoin, and what's the definition of a shtar? Whether it's raya b'ksav midas ha-mischav, eidus b'ksav ha-mischav, he showed the nafkamina. We'd always give definitions. He would always take a gemara and give you the background. You don't take a gemara isolated. He'll always give you the background. And after he gives you the background, that's the machloikis. Whether the definition is like this or the definition is like that. Always by giving the background, enough background, he would enlighten you as to what's going on over here. You can't take a gemara, one line of the gemara. He had a bekiyas. He didn't know what daf it was in another mesichta. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein would sit next to him. So he would say, What daf is it, Aaron? Daf samach gimel amud beis. Daf yud gimel amud up. You know, he'd always scream out, what daf? He wouldn't remember, Rav Sol, he wouldn't remember what. He remembered which mesichta. He didn't remember. A lot of times, I don't remember where it is, but I remember it's a fat taisus on amud aleph or a skinny taisus on amud. He wouldn't remember amud aleph, amud beis. When he would be looking for a gemara, he would see, no, this topic notes after that. That topic notes before that topic. He knew in what order the topics were. He didn't remember Amud Aleph, Amud Beis, Fat Taisa, Skinny Taisa. He didn't remember that. He would always explain the Gemara here based on another Gemara. You don't explain just by logic alone. You can't figure out everything just... You have to place everything into proper perspective. So he didn't have a dripping bekiyas to quote verbatim what daf, one amud, and where the Taisa is. He knew what the dinim were, and based on the dinim and other gemaras, he would explain. Well, this gemara always explaining everything by giving you the background, and he always took the most complicated topic and he made it simple. He was a fantastic orator. I wasn't there. People say the story that every year he had yard sites for his father on Gimel Shvatzeh. He would deliver a big shiur. People would fly in from out of town. People would fly in from out of town to come to the Yortzeit Shir. It was like a gala event. You'd have hundreds of people streaming in the streets to come to the Yortzeit Rosh. They would greet each other. Afreilich and Yortzeit. Like you say, Agut Niantiv. People were so cheerful on the day of the Yortzeit. The Yortzeit Shir would be at least 4 hours. Many people said it used to be 2 hours in Gemara and 2 hours a long drasha. And the drasha was always usually related to the Gemara. Some aspect of the Gemara. So they say the story goes that on one occasion after he finished delivering the Yortzeit Drasha, so one of the listeners walked up, the Yortzeit Drasha was always delivered in Yiddish, a beautiful, impeccable Yiddish. At the end, someone walked up to him and he said to him in English, Rabbi Soloveitchik, did anybody ever tell you that you're a good actor? So they say, without batting an eyelash, he said, drama is an integral part of communication. He was a natural dramatist. He didn't take any courses on drama. He was a naturally dramatic. They say the story about Rabbi Lau, Chief Rabbi Lau, when he was a student, a teenager in Kol Torah. So he wanted to leave the yeshiva to go into drama. So the head of the yeshiva that time was Reb Shlomo Zalman Neubach. He was the Rosh Yeshiva. So he told him he's interested in going into drama. He wants to leave. So the story goes that he told him, why do you have to leave the yeshiva? Learn and get smicha and use your dramatic talents in the rabbinate. So that's what he did. He's a dramatic speaker. Gewaldig. When Rabbi Lau gets up to talk, he's meridic. He's a gewaldig actor. He's a natural actor. He didn't take any courses in drama. So Rabbi Soloveitchik was also meridic dramatic. He was a very good speaker. Taka, drama is an integral part of communication. He always used to say, if he would ask a student, say over the shir, what did he say? He said, I understood it, but I can't explain it. So he'd always say, my grandfather, Rabbi Chaim, said, if you can't say it over, then you didn't understand it. If you understand it well, then you can say it over. That's what he always said. When he would explain things, he would explain it so well. He would dramatize it, explain it so well, because he, in his mind it was so clear. All of the ideas that he said basically are not original. Everything says in the Ksois HaChoshim and the Nesivas and the Eglei Tal, everything says. But he said it much better than the way they said it. He would explain it so much better. He was fantastic. As opposed to Ramosha Feinstein has tshuvas. And he comes up with original ideas that don't appear before at all. He has a lot of original ideas. Rav Soloveitchik's ideas all appear in print, except that he says it much clearer than in the earlier generations. People had the attitude of Moshe Feinstein. He was very traditional. Rav Soloveitchik, he was modern. Everything is different. It's not true. Rav Soloveitchik would speak. He would dress so impeccably, you know, like this, and he would speak so dramatic. You'd think that he's saying something. He's just saying over what it said in the Gemara. Just saying over the Pesukim Mechumash. But he'd be so dramatic about it, you would get the impression as if he's saying something. Now, Feinstein would talk under his bunches. You know, he wasn't a good public speaker, and he talked Yiddish, and he was a hunched over like this, and it was very short. So you thought that he's saying over all the things. Rabbi Feinstein was a revolutionary. He said original things. At Lakewood, they're upset about many of the tshuvas of Moshe. He invented new ideas. He came up with new ideas in Psak Halacha. Rabbi Soloveitchik never came up with new ideas. Always very traditional, very classical, whatever it says in Shulchan Aruch. A lot of people have the mistaken impression of Rabbi Soloveitchik. He didn't hold for Minhagim. That's a big mistake. He was a stickler for Minhagim. Ridiculous. A minhag that says in Shulchan Aruch, he said, you got to keep it. Either Mishneh Berurah says that for the last 500 years nobody observes it. He doesn't hold from that. He says in Shulchan Aruch, you got to observe the minhag. Unless you feel that it's a minhag shtus. So there's some minhagim that he thought a minhag shtus. Every gadol has like that. The Chazon Ish held, when you go to sell the chametz to the rabbi, the rabbi makes a kabbalas kinyan with the balabatim to authorize him to serve as the shlech to sell the chametz. So the Chazon Ish said, based on the Rambam, that's a minhag shtus. So he never did the kabbalas kinyan. A lot of minhagim like that. So Rav Soloveitchik disagreed with him. What are you talking about? He said the Rambam starts off by saying it's a minhag shtus, then the Rambam defends it. Rav Soloveitchik was insistent. You have to make the kabbalas kinyan. And even a difficult circumstance, every year, every rabbi is about to sell the chametz and every Pesach in the morning. So Balabas calls up on the phone the last minute, Rabbi, I forgot to come to ask you to sell the chametz for me. So how's he going to make the Kabbalah kinyan with the Balabas? So Rabbi Zalvejic gave two suggestions. How to fulfill a minig even in such a case. He said, there's a minig in Shulchan Rambam, an old minig, you have to do Kabbalah kinyan. He gave two suggestions himself. Whatever he thought is a minig, every gadol has to determine what he thinks is a minig shtus, what's not a minig shtus. He had a different definition, what's a minig shtus. He thought, the Rabbi Natan has a famous tshuva that's printed on the bottom of the Mordechai Gittin, in the Shulti Gibarim, on the bottom of the page. He says that the word minig is the same osius as Gehenna. Mem nun, hey gimel, spells gimel, hey nun, mem. You observe a minig, it goes straight to Gehenna. Sometimes it's a minig shtus and you're not supposed to observe it. Taisus on the first Mishnah, Bava Basra, it's like that. You see from the Mishnah that certain minhagim you're not allowed to follow. So what's the definition of a minig shtus? Rav Soloveitchik's position was, it was based on a biur, many biur hagro. A minig shtus, a minig that doesn't have any kiyum. Every minig has to be a fulfillment of some sheet or another, some din or another. Like called the tikkun rabbanon came, there is a tikkun, some minhagim. Of course, the minig has to have a reason, but it has a good reason, that's not enough. It has to be a kiyum of some kind of a din or another. So when he would give shiurim on Shulchan Aruch, that was already unusual. He gave shiurim on Shulchan Aruch. Most rabbanim only give shiurim on Gemara. He gave shiurim on Shulchan Aruch and made the Shulchan Aruch alive. It was lebedik, not just boring details. Like he said, Yeridaya is not just pots and pans. He made Yeridaya conceptual. He made it lebedik. He gives shiurim on Yeridaya. He would spend more time explaining minhagim than all of his contemporaries put together. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Yanky Kamenetsky, Rabbi Hutner, Rabbi Gifter, all of them put together didn't spend so much time as he did explaining minhagim, and he usually had it based on the Biuri Hagra, the Vilna Gaon. Whenever the Shulchan Aruch has a minig, he always knocks sense, not give you the reason. Of course every minig, you have Tamei HaMinhagim. There are books and books written about Tamei HaMinhagim. Of course every minig has a reason, but still it's a minig shtus unless it's a kiyum of something or another. So he would always explain what the kiyum is. Once in a while, the Vilna Gaon says that something has no kiyum, so he makes fun of it. The Vilna Gaon will make fun of it then. No kiyum, so it's a minig shtus. Rabbi Soloveitchik had heavy, heavy traditions. When he would say the shir, originally he said the shir in Yiddish, till it was one student who he realized he didn't know Yiddish. So the next day he switched the shir into English. He never realized that there's such a thing. A student doesn't know Yiddish. He always gave the shir in Yiddish. He would say verbatim what he heard from his father. He would say sometimes, Chayav Adam Loimer B'Loshan Rav. You have to say over exactly. He would say over expressions that in Yiddish that are not the normal way of saying things. Because that's the way his father said this. Momen hegdish bikinyonai. Oh, he would have a lot of times expressions like that. He would be quoting verbatim. Then when he switched over into English, so the first couple years, it was uncomfortable because he was translating, he was thinking in Yiddish, he's translating it to English. He had to say it over two times, three times till he got it straight. Then later on, he already knew how to speak English better. He didn't have to work so hard. He would be very makbid. He would be very medactic to say over exactly the way he heard from his father. He said as a child, when he would learn with his father, so the father would ask him, say over what we said. So he would say it over in his own words. He said the father would smack him, you have to say it over exactly the way I said it. Word for word the way I said it. I had his brother for chemistry, Shmuel Soloveitchik. He taught chemistry in the college. So he said, he was a very nervous person. So he said, we used to both learn with the father. And after we learned, Shmuel Soloveitchik was a little younger. Rabbi Soloveitchik was the older brother, he was a little younger. The Rabban Soloveitchik was much younger. In fact, Shmuel Soloveitchik died first. So one of the Rabbanim met Rabbi Soloveitchik at a wedding, so he says, "I just saw your brother last week." "My brother? My brother is not alive!" Says Rabban Soloveitchik, "Oh yeah, he is my brother." Because he was so much younger than him, it's like his son. He thought his brother is Shmuel Soloveitchik. "And my brother is not alive." Says, "No, he met Rabban Soloveitchik." "Yeah, of course he was alive." Yeah. So Shmuel Soloveitchik was, I think, a year or two younger. So they went with the father at the same time. So Shmuel said, when the father would grill him after that, he said, "Did you understand?" He said in Yiddish, he would scream, "Did you understand?" So I always used to say yes. My brother Yosha Beryl always said no. The father would always smack him. "You don't understand. Say it over." So he said, "That's why I became the chemist. And he became the Rosh Hashir. Because I always understood. And he never understood. So that's why the father kept on smacking him. Made him say it over again. Till he understood it. Till he said exactly." Shmuel Soloveitchik said, "To be brought up in my father's home and not to learn, not to know how to learn, you had to be a genius." "My brother's not a genius." "Of course he's going to learn. The father poured so much work, so much he's always hacking. You have to be a genius not to know how to learn, to be brought up by my father's home." He had so many traditions from his father, from his this grandfather, the other grandfather. They had two grandfathers. Everybody has two grandfathers. He would talk about both grandfathers. They were so different. One was a holy tzaddik, it was always fasting Taneisim. Rav Chaim was on a different style. He was a blend of all the traditions, the grandfather's tradition, from this side, the grandfather's tradition. He met so many gedolim in Europe, and he picked up from all of them. He would say, over different hanhagas, there were things that he heard from his uncle, Rav Elvela. In Europe, there was a period of time where they were all together. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Rav Elvela Soloveitchik, there was a year and a half. Rav Soloveitchik was about 15 years old. They were all together. And they were learning all day and all night. They were all learning together. So he told them his stories about his uncle, about his father, about his grandfather. Very fascinating. Had many traditions from the Rabbanim in Europe. We used to wonder a lot of times, why does he do everything different from everybody else? He gets an aliyah, he turns to the side. Everything was different by him. Why doesn't he do everything normally? So then we got a little older. We looked in Shulchan Aruch. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. We never heard of that. I remember my uncle passed away, published a book, Echoes of the Nightingale. Lord Soloveitchik is a nightingale. When the government required that everyone had to take a family name, so they had a tradition that they are Levium. They had a tradition that they were descendants of the Mishorim in the Beis HaMikdash. The Levium were divided into two groups. There were the Mishorim who sang, and the Shoarim who locked the gates. So their family tradition has it that they are Levium, who are descendants. He didn't have a good voice at all. Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't know how to sing. But that was their tradition. So when they had to take family names, so they adopted the name Soloveitchik, which means a nightingale, which is a bird that sings nicely. So my uncle wrote a book, Echoes of the Nightingale. He wrote different things. He doesn't remember whether it's his own or it's from Rabbi Soloveitchik. Some things he writes, he remembers for sure it's from Rabbi Soloveitchik. An entertaining little book in English. So he writes there in the book, on one occasion he was driving Rav Soloveitchik from New York to Boston, he was driving him back. It was the last night to say Kiddush Levana. Rav Soloveitchik said, "Givald, I didn't say Kiddush Levana, let's go out of the car and we'll stop for 2 minutes, I'll say Kiddush Levana." So he says Kiddush Levana, and then he said to me three times, "Shalom Aleichem, Aleichem Shalom, Shalom Aleichem," to one person. So I was wondering, where did he get that from? This man does everything that we always say Shalom Aleichem to three different people. You don't have three people, so you don't say. So I figured I'd look it up in the Kaf HaChaim. Kaf HaChaim has all the other minhagim. So I took out the Kaf HaChaim, but before you find the Kaf HaChaim on the bottom of the page, you got to find what it says on top of the page. So lo and behold, on top of the page it says, and there are more, and you say to your friend three times, Shalom Aleichem. Doesn't say, say to three people. So I remember soon after, I never heard of that before. So I remember I visited Eretz Yisrael afterwards, and Rabbi Goldwich, Zechanu Lebracha, the Rosh Yeshiva in Kerem Yavu, always chalashing to hear, "Tell me something from Rabbi Soloveitchik." So I said, "You know what I heard? That he used to say Kiddush Levana to one person, and he said Shalom Aleichem." He said, "The Brisker Rav always did that. It would be after Meir of Amatzoi Shabbos, They would walk out into the courtyard and say, Kiddush Lavana. There were 30 people there. He would always say to one person three times, Shalom Aleichem. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. He was a big stickler on all the minhag. If something is a minhag shtus, he wouldn't observe it, but a minhag, he would observe the minhag the way it says. A lot of things we always wondered, where did he get this from? Then when we learn Shulchan Aruch, that's what it says. A lot of traditions, family traditions, traditions from Balazhan, traditions from other Gedolim, other Rabbanim. Everything had a mocker. He didn't invent things. He didn't make up. Once in a while he came up with the original Chiddush in Hanhagah. But most of his Hanhagas were traditions that he was carrying over from Europe. He had a tremendous sense of humor. He used to tell a lot of stories in class, stories about Gedolim. He used to say jokes in order to explain the Gemara. Gave you a full picture. I remember after he passed away, so I published a little book, a collection of different things. So I met one of Rabbi Gifter's sons-in-law, who's now in Eretz Yisrael, Avram Chaim Foyer, your mishpacha. So he read the little book. He said, "Wow." He thought that Rabbi Gifter was something. He said, "Rabbi Soloveitchik, you have what to say about the Kol Olam and about Yitta. Every page in the Siddur, every pasuk in the Chumash." Every line in the Shulchan Aruch, he had something to say. Had a comment. Yes, no, maybe. Had a comment on everything. When we learn Gemara now, whenever I learn any Gemara, I never learned Pchoris, but I never learned Zvach. We learn Gittin, Kiddushin, Yivamas. We learn the normal Masichtas. Any Gemara that I learn, Rabbi Soloveitchik made a comment on this. On every page in the Gemara, on every page in Shulchan Aruch, there's always something that he made a comment on, a sharp comment. We don't paskin like that. He has a tradition. We do paskin like that. A nuance like this, like that. He had traditions and comments on everything. He had a hekif on everything. Not just one little corner. He had what to say about everything. It's a very fascinating, very colorful individual. There's a lot to say. Very good. How about tzlacha? Learn up a storm.
I have to come.